Let's all rise for the Pledge of Allegiance, brought to us tonight by none other than Sergeant Williams.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Someday. Soon.
Okay, roll call.
Good evening, Commissioners. I'd like to take the roll call. Commissioner Hurd?
Present.
Commissioner Chair Hartwig?
Present.
Commissioner Pitts? Commissioner Pitts is excused.
She's excused.
Commissioner Main?
Present.
Commissioner Montgomery?
Present.
Commissioner Castillo?
Present.
And Commissioner Nagraj?
Present.
Thank you.
Next item is approval of the minutes from our last meeting.
I will move to approve.
Second.
Third. Okay, all those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed? And the motion carries unanimously. Are there any modifications to the agenda? Okay, hearing none, we will move on to new business, and we will start with actually a very uplifting item, item A.
Good evening, Commissioners. I'll turn the mic over to Chief Carol Duplessis, who will give a presentation on the summer bike program.
Carol Duplessis, Chief of Police. This is a program we're very, very proud of. Every year, we try to get even more and more creative on the youth activities. You know, we started 16 years ago with our summer camps, and we've had baseball teams. This year, we really want to get the kids outside of the city. One thing we notice on the properties is that we don't really see our kids riding bicycles a lot. We know from being young, it's a great exercise, great activity for them. So what we did, we actually purchased 15 bicycles, and we actually took the kids on excursions this year. From the 15, we really pretty much loaded them all up with our cadets and officers, and we took them to Treasure Island. We took them to Coyote Hills in Fremont. We took them to Berkeley Marina, and we took them on excursions. It was a great partnership, not only just to have the activity for the kids, but also for the officers and the kids to engage, for our cadets and the kids and our cadets and officers to continue their engagement. But at the end of the summer, what we wanted to do was just not have these bikes sit. What we want is for the kids to continue riding. So we selected a group of the kids that we're actually going to give all 15 bikes to. And we have a number of them here. I understand a lot of them couldn't make it. We know today's first day of school, and of course we do prefer them to go to school and get everything ready than to be here. But we will see to it that they get the bikes. But a number of kids did come to get their bikes today. So I would like to ask Executive Director Johnson, our chair, and Officer Luther Dupree, Sergeant of the Crime Prevention Unit, to come stand up front so we can present these bikes. And I'm going to ask Officer Denise Smith to come to the mic. She spearheaded this activity, and I want to welcome her, and I want to thank her for her dedication and the job she did.
Thank you, Chief. I'm Officer Denise Smith with Oakland Housing Authority Police Department. Like Chief stated, this was a great program. The kids, some of them had never been to the locations in which we took them. They had never been there. Some kids had actually only been on bikes once or twice. So that part was wonderful to get them out there to exercise, to, you know, be a part of that, to help them grow. And then some of the stuff that we did on the bike rides, it wasn't just bike rides. We actually would have conversations with them, talk about their life. And then at Coyote Hills, we actually went in and we were able to see some of the animals that are there and talked about the habitats and how to help them. And they got to actually hold some of the animals and that kind of stuff. So it was more than just riding a bike. It was more than just that. So we had a great time. The kids, I know, had a great time because they would tell us. And so I'm just happy to be a part of that. And thank you, Chief, for, you know, doing it. Most people wouldn't even take the time to, you know, involve that part of the community because they're kind of just kind of left out. So I'm glad that we actually take the time to involve the children and let them know that we're not, you know, police is not always the bad guy. We're here to have fun with you, enjoy, help, you know, help you when you need it. So even now when they see us in the community, they'll stop and they'll be like, hey, Officer Smith, Officer, you know, Sergeant Dupree, ask one of the officers stuff. So there, it's good that we're building a healthy relationship that is not just a negative thing. So three kids who were part of the program all summer are here. So I want them to come up so I can present them with their certificates, and they'll be getting a bike as well. And we actually are going to give them help as well so they can have their safety equipment when they get out there. So DJ Demetrius, come up.
Chief, do you have some OPD officer here also for the same event? Okay.
With A. Oh, okay. Okay, then we are moving on to item B.
Good evening. Item B is consideration of a nomination of Rena Webb to serve as the Oakland Housing Authority representative on the City of Oakland Community Police Advisory Board. And I'll turn the mic over to Chief Carol Duplessis.
I have to stand here until they get the cordless mic. But we're very proud today to bring to you Rena Webb for the nominee for the Community Policing Advisory Board. You remember last year we actually brought another person and you guys actually nominated and approved them for the board as it worked out that they weren't able to serve. Through the work and the Malcolm Williams, his community policing, he actually brought up this nominee, and we're very happy to have such a phenomenal young lady. Executive Director Johnson and I, we actually were happy to have lunch with her and Officer William about a month or so ago. And we need to say we were very impressed, very impressed. Not too many times can you get someone of such youth that has such balance in her ideas in regards to community, policing, youth, very, very balanced, very, very fair. And I think ultimately, you know, as she serves on the board as a representative from the Housing Authority, she'll be a great inspiration and she'll be a huge plus and a huge benefit, not only, you know, for our own interests, but for the Oakland Police Department. See, we got Captain Joyner here, as well as the citizens of Oakland. So without further ado, I'd like to bring her up to the mic and have her introduce herself to this board, and also Officer Malcolm Williams, just in case you have any comments or questions in regards to the board. As you remember, Officer Williams was our representative on the Community Policing Advisory Board for 8 years, 7 or 8 years prior to the last nominee. So I'd like to bring Brianna Webb.
Good evening. My name is Rania Webb. My name is Rania Webb. I'm a resident of Oakland. I was speaking to Officer Williams, and he was telling me about the Community Policing Advisory Board and what they were trying to accomplish and what they have been doing, and he just thought it might be a good fit for me. I've done a lot of things in community service, everything from feeding the homeless with the Mother Mary Ann Wright Foundation to working with UBASE for the after-school mentoring programs, as well as I have 3 kids, and I at least volunteer once a week in their classrooms. I try to give about an hour to each class. I always just give. My kids and I actually sometimes go and feed the homeless and just make dinner for them and go feed them and just kind of give back. And so I just believe this is another way for me to give back, but just even on a higher level that will reach more people and do a broad difference.
Good evening, Chairperson and members of the Oakland House Authority Commission. My name is Jerry. I've been with the police department for 27 years. I'm not a sergeant, but I hope this comment you made by you reflect in my check coming up. I'll take that. But anyway, I was with the Community Policing Advisory Board for 8 years, close to 8 years. And during the time, that's when it first was initiated, and was based on the 57 beats that was required by the citizens of Oakland to have an officer man that area. So anyway, during the first 4 or 5 years, they were trying to get their act together as far as formulating a policy for the police department. But it became kind of trying later on in the years, because here I am sitting on a board in uniform, and here's the board telling the police department on how to do things, you better do things this way, you know. And so it got very kind of controversy, but it was challenging to say. However, I did meet Ms. Webb during our, we have this another procedure called a mediation that we have. And I was impressed at that, because she let us know that she wanted a mediation with a neighbor of hers, because she felt that if you're going to live there together, we might as well get along. So during the mediation process, which we found to be very successful at about a 94% success rate. And what I mean by that is that this was put in place so that officers wouldn't go out for the same call each time with the same issues. Repeatedly without solving it. More or less, the police officer became a uniform presence, and that's all, and not really trying to address the issue. So our department put this in place to address these issues. And we found out that a lot of issues was just miscommunication and perception from the neighbors. So needless to say, I was impressed with her at the mediation board. She's very articulate. She was young, and I thought she'd be a perfect fit. Of course, for years, over 8 years, the Community Policing Advisory Board has been looking for the young people to put in their views on how things are from their eyesight and from their age. Since most of the issues, the concerns are the younger people within the city of Oakland. So I'm just overjoyed that, and I know she'll be a good fit and a good representative for the authority on the board. Are there any questions? You. Okay.
Right. Thank you, Officer Williams.
Okay. So, Commission, before you is a resolution requesting that you nominate Ms. Webb to the Community Policing Advisory Board. So we're available if you have any other questions or if you have comments.
Can Can I move it now?
You may move it, Mr. Moses.
I will second.
All right. It has been moved and seconded. So all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed? There are none. So, Rania, you have been unanimously approved as our representative.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Can I say something?
Yes.
Just so you know, Chief Duplessis, I was prepared to move it when you first started talking, but he asked me to give you a chance to speak, so we'll let you talk.
For the next item, if you just want to move it without me speaking.
Nobody ever really wants to hear me speak anyway.
Well, I want to thank our police department for both of the last items. I mean, this is really wonderful to see this kind of community involvement and community work on the behalf of the police. And I think it really, I mean, this is what OHA now is all about. We're more than housing, and we're really doing what we can do, everything we can do to help people. And so with that, we're now moving on to item C, which Chief Duplessis would like us to pass with no discussion.
Item C is a recommendation authorizing the executive director to negotiate a memorandum of understanding with the City of Oakland Police Department and to provide additional funding for the ShotSpotter technology. I'd mentioned in a couple of past meetings that we're going to come forward with some additional requests for funds related to what we could do to help make our community safer. Specifically, we're going to come forward with future items related to Lockwood Gardens and some things that we're proposing there. We're currently negotiating with the city related to some changes in the flow of traffic in the streets that we're hoping to be successful. We want to also put some cameras there and some other things, so those will be coming forward. This item is somewhat related to that effort, and I would turn it over to the chief to give a presentation and discussion on it.
I want to thank Captain Hersey Joyner. He's here from the Oakland Police Department to speak on behalf of the city and the police department. He's also brought two members of ShotSpotters. I'll call him up in a second so he can speak to this. Oakland Police Department has ShotSpotter, and for those of you who might not know what it is, it's a system that alerts police immediately anytime gunshots are fired within the city of Oakland. And I'll let Captain Joyner tell you about the proximity, how close it is. Our department has been familiar with the system for a while. At times where, you know, we hear or we understand there were gunshots, what we have had to do is call the Oakland Police Department's dispatch to find out exactly where did they occur, whether it was confirmed, and usually we're behind in times. I mean, it's generally takes several minutes after for us to vet that information. Recently, the Oakland Police Department came to us. They want to expand ShotSpotter. And currently, it's mainly in West Oakland, the lower parts, and in Far East Oakland. There's a number of areas that are not covered by ShotSpotter that are contained around a lot of our scattered sites. We spoke to them in regards to how can we enhance our own technology by partnering with the Oakland Police Department. And what we have proposed for us to get out of this by assisting them in their expansion is we're going to get full access to the system. All of our officers from their laptops, they'll have access to ShotSpotters. If, in fact, a shot does go off in the city of Oakland, the officers will be immediately alerted over their computers inside the car, where we've just taken minutes away into seconds in order for us to respond. I know the Oakland Police Department would be very happy with this because, quite frankly, with their shortage of staff, any type of force multiplication by getting somebody else to be able to respond a lot quicker, especially, for instance, on our property where we definitely know we want to get there as fast as possible to try to resolve whatever situation there is, they would be greatly appreciative of this. The implementation of this is not what we're requesting to assist the Oakland Police Department with. There's a significant amount more. What we're going to propose, and what we have proposed to the City of Oakland, is $150,000 that we would furnish them now to get the implementation going, $75,000 next year. And we will sign an MOU between the Oakland Police Department and the Housing Authority, where we will have no additional costs. Oakland Police Department will have to maintain the system for the future, but we will have to be included with all technological upgrades at no cost to the Housing Authority. And the Oakland Police Department has agreed to this, which makes me very happy. Like I said, it's you know, pushing the technology in our hands, it's going to be great. Not only that, I mean, it, not being a 24-hour operation, to be able to run analysis and to look at other reports at times where our officers are not there to determine whether things have happened at the time where we didn't have officers on duty is going to benefit us greatly. There are too many times that we find out days later that things have happened. You know, we have a lot of property, a lot of addresses. And, you know, clearly to be able to get as much data right now and to be data-driven is something that I'm very excited about, and I think it's going to just improve and enhance our operations. So I'd like to call Captain Joyner to the mic.
Good evening. My name is Ersie Joyner, E-R-S-I-E-J-O-Y-N-E-R. First and foremost, to the Commissioner Board, I'm proud and humbled to be here making a presentation to you today. To all in attendance, thank you for having me. I'm honored to be a guest. And I have to say, stepping away from being professional, it's a cooler situation being in front of all of you than the Oakland City Council. I was just telling them just a few minutes ago, I asked the ShotSpotter people, hey, have you ever gone to a Oakland City Council meeting? And they went, yeah. I go, this is a lot different. They went, yeah. So with all of that said, thank you for your time and attention to this matter. More importantly, I'd like to pay homage where homage is due. And we wouldn't be here right now if not for Mr. Eric Johnson, Ms. Patricia Eisen, and Chief Duplessis. In fact, Councilmember Desley Brooks brought all of us to the table, including ShotSpotter, and closed the doors, locked it, and told us to work out a deal. And the ironic thing is Chief Duplessis went in, had a vision, had in his mind what he wanted to do, and I was just blessed the fact that it's the same way I wanted to go. So it worked out well. I take my hat off to him and all the great things he's doing, and it's actually a match made in heaven. With all of that said, I'm a lifelong City of Oakland resident. I live here now. I spent the last 21 years here serving the citizens of Oakland. And I'm a firm believer of my 12 years of homicide experience that there's way too many death, way too much death and bloodshed on our streets. And more importantly, a lot have to do with young children. I won't bore you guys with all of those details and my stories along the way, but I will leave you with this. Just this year alone, to date, we've had 77 homicides in the City of Oakland. We've had over 500 incidents of gunshot cases. That's cases where we actually responded and took reports. Ironically, year to date to where we are right now, we've had 3,358 ShotSpotter incidents, which means that there's over 3,300 gunshots that have gone off here in the City of Oakland, and clearly they don't match in regards to how many times people were calling the police. Chief Duplessis and I had many conversations about this, and one of the things we both came to the understanding of is that ShotSpotter is not only going to be a great tool for the men and women out there policing the streets, but it's going to be a tool to help build relationships with the community. I believe that when there's a gunshot in a neighborhood and the police don't show up, that we become enablers to those gunshot suspects, and more importantly, I think we send a bad message to the community that we don't care about them. That's not the case, but that's the message that we're sending. ShotSpotter affords us an opportunity to actually go out there and do something about it. I'm a firm believer in if you can track it, you can predict it. And if you can predict it, then you can prevent it. And, you know, it's great to be able to respond to gunshots, but how I see overarching this program working is being able to predict, stop, and prevent gun violence from happening here in the city. And one of the things I wanted to talk about was kind of like the implementation stage, how things are going to work. Chief Duplessis hit it on the nail on the head when he started talking about alerts, things of that nature. Currently, there's over 49% of the city that's being covered with ShotSpotter. That 49% was chosen due to empirical data supporting gun violence, things of that nature, calls for service. We have now requested through the city through the city council to expand this system to cover another additional 20% of the city. This will include the North Oakland area and the Fruitvale area, which through empirical data is probably the most needed areas here in the city of Oakland to expand this service. Some high-profile cases have been made so far this year with ShotSpotter. I know that liability is a big issue for people, especially sitting on this dais. And one thing that ShotSpotter can also do is they offer forensic analysis in regards to officer-involved shootings. They offer expert people who will come and testify in any cases that OPD, as well as the Oakland Housing Authority, has had. And they've done that so far for us this year. The last one I could think about was the Fremont police officer who was an undercover officer who was shot. And the defendant's claim to fame was that they never said police. And ShotSpotter was able to offer forensic analysis and disprove his story. What I want to do, without going into further details, actually call up the Senior Vice President, Joe Hawkins, and Scott Beisner, who's in charge of sales and operations, to be able to answer any technical questions. Because if you start getting into that, I'm way in over my head. Gentlemen.
Good evening. I'm Joe Hawkins.
And I'm Scott Beisner.
Are there any questions anyone might have in regards to the technical components or how this is going to work in regards to collaboration?
Yeah, I have a question. I just have two questions. One, I'm really glad to see this happening. We know a lot of gunshots taking place. People are dying, and children, all these dead. It has to stop. And my question was on the second page. It said that it's going to be implemented with all of the open housing building properties.
Well, what we mean by the implementation is that the surrounding will cover all the properties. All of our scattered sites, yes, absolutely. He has a map, and he can show you the geographical boundaries. But the boundaries of ShotSpotter will include all of our scattered sites as well as all of our large sites.
Yeah, what you see in this map in the black boundaries is the existing ShotSpotter coverage. About 7 square miles, about 1.5 miles in West Oakland and 5.5 miles in East Oakland. The red borders are representative of the expanded coverage area that we're proposing. 2.5 square miles, or actually 2.6 square miles in North Oakland and 4 square miles in the Fruitvale area. I completed the analysis on the map that you see. The green to red represents the calls for shots fired. These are calls that are coming into 911 during a over 2 year period. These are actually not gunshots that were detected by ShotSpotter. Keep in mind that about 20% of people who hear a gunshot will actually pick up the phone and dial 911. And when they do, they say, I heard a shot outside my residence. And they don't have the ability to actually say for a high degree of certainty where that gunshot occurred. So this actually represents just a fifth of what's really going on out there. So inside the black coverage areas, we have a much better, clear idea of what's happening. So it addresses the alert and response. We also, as Captain Joyner mentioned, we assist in prosecution, so we can actually do a very forensic analysis of this. And this is the same kind of service that would be offered to anything that happens on Housing Authority properties. What you see in the pink triangles, those are all of the Housing Authority addresses. And so you can see where those fall within the existing coverage area and the expanded coverage area. Existing coverage is about 51%. With the expansion, we can get up to 82% of coverage for Housing Authority addresses. That's quite a bit of coverage. So not only does it assist the city, but it also addresses the gun violence that's happening in the housing areas. So as ShotSpotter, we really become more of a partner in your gun violence reduction program. Not just a technology that you buy. You're subscribing to a data service, and we're there as partners with you in your gun violence reduction program. So that's why we're here today, and we really hope we can assist you with this program.
Let me just also say the what you see in red is a representation of probably around 200 plus scatter sites that now will be covered by it. Yeah, and also just make sure that. With Captain Joyner takes back the right message that we're here to assist them in their violence reduction program.
Yeah.
Duly noted, sir, and understood.
Well, one of the other things I want to make clear is when I originally did this analysis of what areas we plan to do our expansions in, it was actually after the fact that we overlaid the housing authority addresses. So we really didn't initially design this around where all the housing is. We were actually designing it around where most of the gunfire was happening. It just so happens that we're able to cover 82% with the expansion. We'll be able to cover 82%. So that's just a coincidence and not really by design. Well, actually, I can defer to you if you wish to.
Sure. It's a very good question. The first thing that happens is we need to actually identify the locations where our sensors will go. That's obviously kept very confidential so that the general population doesn't know what these are or where they exist. But we use the coverage map that Scott's shown and you've all had a chance to see to map out every location where a sensor is going to be placed. On either privately owned buildings, government-owned buildings, schools, houses of worship, in very rare cases, private residences, but generally public and privately owned buildings, commercial buildings. And then we actually have to go out and contact each one of those building owners or representatives, get their permission to put the sensor at that location. In some cases where a building is not convenient, we'll use a utility pole. It's usually our second choice. Once that's done, the installation of all the sensors can happen very, very rapidly, generally in a matter of a couple of weeks. And then the system goes live within days after that. So it all happens pretty quickly, the longest thing being securing permissions from all the property owners. Now, in the case where many of these properties might be housing authority buildings, to get a single blank permission for all of those in one fell swoop definitely accelerates the whole process.
Another thing I'd like to clarify is that a sensor doesn't necessarily have to be in proximity of the gunfire. In fact, the closest sensor doesn't always give us the best solution for where the gunfire occurred. The way our sensors work is much like how the USGS detects earthquakes and where the epicenter of the earthquake is. So they deploy an array of sensors, and once an earthquake happens, it goes out and essentially a circle. Same thing with gunfire. So we measure the arrival time of that sound at each one of those sensors. So we cover a wide area. Generally, there are 16 to 20 sensors that are placed in a square mile. So we need four sensors to participate in order to locate a gunshot solution. So even the slightest tap heard by a sensor that's over a mile away might help us with a much better solution, and we're actually doing triangulation is you know, without going into too much math or geometry, we're drawing hyperbolas, and where those hyperbolas intersect is where our shooter is, and it's to a high degree of certainty where that gunfire is. I just saw a article in one of our sites on the East Coast that they didn't necessarily locate a shooter or a victim, but they found gun casings. So collecting evidence is even an important part of our gun violence reduction program and working with the ATF and using their systems to help identify weapons that are in our community.
Yeah, one question. I noticed that the city has used ShotSpotter since 2006 in certain areas. I'd like to know, has there been a reduction or a decline in the gunshots in those areas, in those neighborhoods, and or is there a percentage that you can kind of give us that has reduced the gunshots in that area?
I'm very glad you asked me that. One of the bullet points I wanted to talk about is the elephant in the room. I'm sure all of you are aware of the city auditor report about the Oakland Police Department and our misuse of technology. ShotSpotter was one of those things that was investigated from the use back in 2006. I wasn't in charge of the program back then, but one thing I do recall back in 2006 is ShotSpotter told us that we were doing it all wrong. And what I meant by that is we had one ShotSpotter computer in our radio room, and we relied on a very overworked communication center to actually use the system, which was basically virtually an early 911 system. How it is deployed now, and we've seen marketed decreases, to answer your question, in regards to gun violence, is the fact that this information comes within 45 seconds of a gunshot coming out. Within 45 seconds, each officer on the street, as well as a dispatcher, gets an alert, a flex alert from ShotSpotter that leads them within 5 meters of where the gunman is. They can actually see it on a Google map, and this is exactly what the Oakland Housing Authority will have in their police cars and in their dispatch center. They will see within 5 meters of where this gunman is, which direction he or she is moving, how many rounds, especially given the things that are in society right now, multiple gunmen, high power rifles, things of that nature, all decreasing risk when responding to a scene and increasing the chance of catching someone. One other thing I wanted to say in that regard too is that one of the things I left out is that we were talking about funds, and I just want to let you know the City of Oakland is committed to this collaboration. Our portion of the funds have already been agreed upon. Once City Council comes back into session at the end of this month, it will be approved. The City Administrator as well as the City Attorneys all approved it, and they put the funds aside in the actual budget.
Okay. Mr. Main.
How do you differentiate between gunshots and firecrackers?
Another great question. There's actually an awful lot of different kinds of things that can trigger an impulsive explosive sound. Could be an M80, could be a jackhammer, a construction site, could be a car backfire, could be a number of things. We spent many, many years with literally MIT PhDs in math, developing algorithms that are able to analyze the acoustic pulses. This is actually sound waves that are coming through the air, not an actual sound. And they all have a different characteristic, much like a fingerprint. And they're able to analyze the pulses that come from each one of the sensors within milliseconds and classify that with a great degree of accuracy as to what's a gunshot versus an M80. Now, some things are a little closer than other things. A hammer hitting this table wouldn't sound like an AK-47, whereas an M80 might if it was a single shot. That's why we have in our Incident Review Center expert human beings that also process those alerts when they come in after the software does. So every alert in the case of Oakland, as Erzy was discussing, the Flex program, comes to our human reviewers. They're staffed 7x24, 365 days a year, holidays, doesn't matter, all day long. They look at every incident as they come in real time. It'll say it's a gunfire incident. They'll review that. They'll listen to the audio, and they'll say, yes, we agree, that's a gunfire incident. If something comes in as an M80 or a firecracker, they listen to that as well. And if they think the software is wrong, they'll reclassify that as a gunfire incident as well and send that along. But the bottom line answer to the question is it's a great deal of math that looks at patterns in the acoustic pulses, all analyzed by software, and then analyzed a second time by human beings when they listen to it.
Okay. So it brings me to my next question, which is an M80 and some of the larger firecrackers are also illegal. Do you go after them also? Same way?
Very good question. In fact, we actually used ShotSpotter this 4th of July. We set up ShotSpotter response teams where we set officers off on a separate radio channel. We used ShotSpotter, the Flex Alert system, to respond, and we made a significant amount of arrests with people who were using illegal fireworks that are extremely dangerous in the community. So, yes, we have done that in the past, and we will continue to do that in the future.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for this. I live in West Oakland, and I hear gunfire, and I'm almost desensitized to it because it's there almost every other day. And then I went to the neighborhood, the little out gathering that we had outside, National Night Out. And I really felt scared just being out in the streets without, because I'm usually in my house, I don't go outside. So that was something that I didn't even know that I felt, how scared I was just to be in my own neighborhood out on the streets. So this is really, really wonderful.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I was going to say that story is exactly the reason why I, as well as Chief Duplessis, do exactly what we do. You know, we could talk about crime, but the fear of crime is what's really prevalent in this city.
I was wondering, for Oakland Housing Authority, how many officers do we have on the streets on any given shift?
Generally, we have 5 to 6 officers.
5 or 6 officers.
Yeah, during shifts.
And each of them are going to have the shot.
Exactly. But we have actually designed our shifts in order to cover and maximize times and days where we have the majority of issues, and not city issues, the majority of issues from our property. So, during the week, and I would say probably Tuesday through Friday, we can have anywhere between 12 and 16 officers during a 10-hour period. But we do try to put people in places and times in order to maximize what our needs are. Mm-hmm. We're not a patrol-based department. Remember, we spoke about that several times. We're here to be able to do the things that the Oakland Police Department can't do and can't respond to, which means we have to be flexible and able to move our staff and resources at any given time.
Right.
As of tomorrow, based upon need, we have probably 3/4 of the department actually reporting at 6 o'clock in the evening for an assignment, and that's what we need to be able to do. We have to keep and maintain that level of flexibility.
Mm-hmm. So my second question is, as I understand it, we rely on the public letting us know when there are gunshots in the neighborhood. Does this system bypass that or complements it, I presume? And also, is there a category to where, we just heard multiple gunshots, let's send some units there? Is there like a bypassing of the public phone calls?
That's a great question. And in fact, absolutely not. Although ShotSpotter is a great tool, it's only one of many. And in fact, earlier this year, I did an analysis looking at one particular neighborhood, and I noticed that only 25% of 911 calls matched the actual alerts for ShotSpotter. So what that told me was that, number one, people in the community are desensitized in regards to gunshots. They either, one, think that the police don't care and they're not going to come. Two, they don't want to get involved. Or three, they think that one of their other neighbors probably called the police, so therefore they don't have to. So what we want to do is we get out there with ShotSpotter, with our media releases, things of that nature. We want people to know that we're investing in technology to make sure that we're providing a good service to them. So I encourage people to continue to call 911, even though we have ShotSpotter.
But let me follow up on that. I mean, and calling 911, I mean, it's not necessarily going to give you an immediate answer or pick up from the phone. I mean, it depends on what they have coming in. But literally, you would have the 911 call come into a dispatcher who's taken information, put it in the system, and then it's picked up by a call taker who all of a sudden now finds available unit, transfers out to the field, where at this point in time, you can have a 3-minute delay. I mean, trying just to get the information, the data out. Mm-hmm. What we have found when we have been right on top of calls where shots have been fired, and we can respond, and we're there within seconds, I mean, with less than 60 seconds, we can get there. The people are still looking out of windows. And at that point in time, guess what? The calls are not necessarily I heard shots. But the calls will come in saying your officers are out there. I saw the person go run. Have them look around that building. And that inspires a tremendous amount of confidence in the public for the police department. And that's really firm partnership. So, this is really just a great response tool in order to get there quicker and to be able to assist the public.
And this is my final question. It's a money question, and I want to say thank you again for the program. But it's $225 just to get it started for the next 2 years. And then you mentioned something about maintaining it afterwards, which is on the Oakland Police Department's side. And after the 2 years, is there anything that we have to do as far as money is concerned?
No.
Ms. Hurd, you had another question?
Yeah, and this is my final question. I've been doing a lot of studying by this convention.
Boy, this is a good one.
It won't stay on. Okay, I'm holding it. Okay, my concern is getting people help. You know, a lot of things are taking place in their minds, they're mentally challenged. You indicated that there were 500 gunshots where you took reports. What happens when you take those reports?
a host of things happen. Just talking about logistics and how things work, one of the biggest phenomena we have here in Oakland is called self-transporting. Individuals will get shot at a location, and they'll end up driving themselves to Highland Hospital. Sometimes you get individuals who tell us that I got shot at 106 in MacArthur, and that's not even the case. So then we spend a lot of resources over there. We still end up taking a report. In the 500 incidents that I spoke of, these are actually 500 gunshot-related crime reports. But it's not indicative of what's really taking place. As I said before, we've had over 3,300 activations of gunshots that we could say are confirmed gunshots here in the city. Now, that means that people either weren't shot, or we also have a huge problem with celebratory gunfire here in the city, where individuals, for whatever reason, go out in their backyards and fire multiple rounds. I'm sure as Ms. Costello's sitting there talking about in her neighborhood. And like I said before, we as law enforcement officers become enablers when we don't respond to that and don't do anything with it. I started a program here in the city of Oakland. What we're doing is we have a crime analyst, and I've had her identify hotspots throughout the city using ShotSpotter data. And what we do with that information, if we link it to probation and parole, if individuals are on probation and parole, we go to those houses and perform searches. If they're not on probation and parole, we send officers out and we tell them that, hey, we're aware that there's gunshots going on and this needs to stop. And it's more of a deterrent, but these are just some of the mechanisms that we're trying to do. Lastly, kind of in closing, one of the things Chief DePlessis always jokes around, we're giving each other a bad time about who's really responsible for crime reduction. But one thing I will say is that I enjoy going to OHA facility because they're so far ahead of the game to where we are as OPD. OPD, we're more of a responsive unit and not being proactive. And I can honestly say that some of the things they're doing with that police department, using the camera system, using their dispatch, now hopefully using ShotSpotter with it, is how I like to see Oakland catch up to where OHA is now.
I'd like to move the item.
Okay, I have one question. I have one question. I'm assuming that since everyone is here and supporting this, who are really the end users, which is you, Chief Joyner, and Chief DePlessis, that you have high confidence in the reliability and usefulness of this as a tool. I mean, I'm confident of that, or you wouldn't be here. But I'm still curious as to what, because I have done a little bit of research on this in the past, because you know, we have people that we had a guy one night just got out of his car and pulled out a gun, put it up in the air, and just started like firing shots in the air. We've had people down at the other end of the street that just thought that the connection boxes on the telephone poles were like pretty cool targets and started shooting them out. I mean, it's just this crazy crap is going on all over the place. But I'm just interested in what the actual statistical failure rate is. I mean, in other words, how many falses do you get that you find out really weren't gunshots? What is the actual reliability?
And speaking to numerical, we're going to go back to 2006 before we started doing Flex Alert. That was a very high thing in regards to trash cans, fireworks, and basically right. The officers out there kind of lost confidence. Now, since 2012, with the new Flex Alert, right. We don't get those. The officers don't see those. We only get gunshot calls. Every now and then, we get a small percentage, meaning 10% or so of that 3,000, which are called 50-50, where the Flex Alert person says, hey, I'm pretty sure this is a gunshot, but I'm not sure, but I'm going to err on the side of caution. So I roughly say 10%, whereas before we were probably... Wow. 50 or 60%. So
you're running at a 90% success rate then, and the 10% is really just a bias toward conservatism. Like, we're not sure, so we're going to jump on it.
Yes, sir. But I always want to make sure that we're clear about our definitions of success rate. When I say 90% success rate is the fact that my officers are responding confidently knowing that there's a gunman that just discharged a firearm. We're still in the process of collecting data right. In regards to did we recover evidence, were there guns recovered, and was there an arrest made? So that's another phenomenon of success.
I understand, but I don't expect a shot spotter to be able to handle that part of the equation. So
for that much money, sir, I asked them to.
For that much money, right, it should. Okay, thank you. Well, we have a motion to approve on the floor. Do we have a second?
Yes, we do.
Okay, we have a second. We have a so all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? It carries unanimously, and thank you,
thank you very much. Mr. Chair, can I, just in closing, let me leave you with this. Roughly some years ago, probably 10 years ago, I was a sergeant working out in East Oakland, and a big thing that was happening out there was a sideshow. And I just want to make sure that you're getting all you can out of your board members, because Commissioner Main was a city council member, and he actually came out on a ride-along on a sideshow, and I actually had a news crew with a video camera in the car. Well, I wanted to impress the city council member, so I stole an officer's police car. I had this brand new, nice police car that I wasn't supposed to be driving. So sure enough, as we were cruising around the city, we end up in a high-speed chase with the city council member and his TV crew from East Oakland all the way out to San Leandro. Well, as we were going into the car chase, a crowd surrounded my police car and started beating dents in this police car that I wasn't supposed to drive. So after we arrested a suspect from San Leandro, I returned back to Eastmont substation thinking I'm getting fired. I go in and do some paperwork. I come back. The city council member, who's now a Commissioner Main, had popped the trunk, took apart the panel, and beat every dent out that police car. Then he told me he had a lot of experience working on race cars. So I want to make sure you guys are using him to his fullest ability. Sir, I never forgot that, and I still thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And we have a car in the garage. We'll see you.
Okay. So we are now moving on to item D. And I believe we have one speaker for item D. Looks like Tara Paille.
I don't see her in the room, but maybe she will show up before we finish our presentation. So let me call the item. It's review and consideration of the fiscal year 2012 MTW Moving to Work annual report to be submitted to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development by the deadline of September 30th, 2012. As you know, we have our meeting in September, which is when we usually consider this. We get the report done actually earlier, thanks to Anna Gwen working very late nights this week. We got it rolled up and in the board packet. It's lacking the financials. The financials need to be added, but they're not available until September 15th, so we have a very short time. So we wanted to do the presentation tonight, and then we'll bring the item back under old business in September's meeting and include the financial documents. So I'm going to turn over to Anna Gwen Simpson, who is our MTW coordinator, but also our senior policy analyst in the executive office.
Good evening. Good evening, commissioners. Good evening. Just been a little short there. Okay. Okay, so as Mr. Johnson described, our financials are not included in our MTW report presentation tonight, but we are going to go over the rest of the report. So just as a little background about the MTW report, it's required by HUD, so the format is prescribed by HUD. They tell us exactly what they want to know in the report, and both and also the layout of how we should lay it out, so that's their design. And it's due 90 days from the end of the fiscal year, and our fiscal year ends June 30th, so it's due September 30th. It covers the period of the previous fiscal year, July 1, 2011, through June 30th, 2012. And it compares our projected outcomes for activities presented in the annual plan with the actual outcomes we achieve both in our regular operations and in relation to our specific MTW activities. And this information is then used by HUD to respond to congressional inquiries and other questions about the MTW program. So there's three requirements that are in our MTW agreement. And they are requirements of the MTW program, and it is to assure that at least 75% of families assisted are very low income, which is less than 50% of area median income, to serve substantially the same total number of eligible low-income families as we did prior to becoming an MTW agency, and to maintain a comparable mix of families by family size as we did prior to becoming MTW. So those three things are in what's called the certification of compliance that you all as a board will be signing off on when it comes for approval in September. So just to show you how we've met those goals in the last fiscal year, this is a graph showing the income group of current residents in all of our programs. So the first bar is public housing. Then we have OPI, which is our scattered site portfolio that used to be public housing. Section 8, which the Section 8 actually includes the OPI information as well. And then all programs is the public housing and the Section 8 put added together. So the dotted line that you can see is 75% at 50% or below. We actually have, in most of our programs, we have 75% are actually 30% or below. So we're serving what's known as extremely low-income families. We are exceeding our goal of 75% in all programs. And in all programs, we had it was a total of 95.8% are at 50% or below area median income. So for our families served, we this is a breakdown of the authorized units and vouchers during fiscal year 2012. So we had 1,605 public housing units, 12,433 vouchers, 973 non-MTW vouchers, which includes the VASH program, moderate rehabilitation, and the mainstream program, and then Shelter Plus Care vouchers, which are administered by the County of Alameda. And there's 242 of those for a total of 15,253 households served, the majority being served through the MTW Housing Choice Voucher Program. So this pie chart here is just to show you a comparison of households by unit size to try and get at having a comparable mix of households by family size. When we originally did this data in 2004, when we were first becoming an MTW agency, we tracked it by households by unit size. So on the left, you have the mix in 2005. And on the right is the mix as of 2012. And you can see, just visually looking at it, that it's relatively, you know, it's very comparable in terms of the breakdown of our families. And the majorities are in the two-bedroom and three-bedroom households. In 2012, we had 37.2% in two-bedroom households and 29.6% in three-bedroom households. And in comparison to 2004, the two-bedroom households went up by about 4%. Three-bedroom households went down about 5%. So very comparable, though. The other ones, you know, stayed relatively constant. So as well as our requirements under the agreement, there are statutory objectives of the MTW program, and we are purpose is to design activities that try and achieve one or more of these goals, and they are to increase housing choices for low-income families, provide incentives for families with children to become economically self-sufficient, and to reduce costs and achieve greater cost effectiveness in federal expenditures. So of all the MTW activities, and the list of MTW activities is on page 24 of the MTW report, but of all of our MTW activities, we had four activities that were not implemented and or placed on hold. Those activities, two of them, the standardized transfer policy and the SRO studio apartment project-based preservation program, those are kind of tied together. That's our goal of the sort of one program of rolling out transfer policy for our public housing residents as well as standardizing our policies across programs. We've put that on hold temporarily. And the other one, the SRO studio one, is part of that revision of those policies. We'll be doing all of that at the same time. Redesigning the Family Self-Sufficiency Program. Currently under the rules for the Family Self-Sufficiency Program, which is a separate grant, the Notice of Funding Availability, which is called a NOFA, which governs how that program operates, has stated that you can't operate that program outside of the guidelines stated in the NOFA. So it wouldn't allow for us to basically do alternatives with our MTW authorizations. If we did do waivers to the program through MTW, we would then have to essentially give up the FSS money for our coordinators. So it kind of became a, you know, sort of a catch-22. The good news is that in this latest NOFA that's going to come out this next year, the MTW office has said that they've changed the rules in the NOFA so that it will allow you to operate the FSS program in accordance with your MTW agreement. So there is possibilities that we could tweak that program or do different things with that program using MTW. But currently it's on hold. And then the short-term subsidy program was a we basically provided some funding to a property that was where the company had gone out of business.
The only time we've used that was OCHI was in financial trouble and the residents were at risk, and so we put this in the plan and were able to help fund the bridge into other nonprofits that allowed for things like the California Hotel to take place.
So those activities are going to remain at current activities for us, which means we can use them again in the future, but we're just putting them on hold because we didn't use them this current fiscal year. Yes? Do you have a question?
Are we planning to put that in place when the Savoy gets up and running also?
The Savoy is already taken care of in terms of project base. This was short-term assistance so that they could maintain the operating so that the tenants would not be displaced. And it's not the same program. And we've only used it the one time, and we don't really anticipate using it again. But I'm kind of the belief we have the authority, so we'll keep it in our plan. It was a pretty rare circumstance that allowed us to use it. Under the new notice and rule that has been published for MTW, there are restrictions on the use of MTW money and affordability. We're fortunate in the use of that money that those properties then became things like the California Hotel because they have long-term affordability, so we met the HUD requirements. But that is something that's come up since we did this project. But keep in mind, this was only some bridge money to keep the lights on, the utilities on, and the cleaning of the site while those were in transition. It's not the long-term subsidy like the Savoy is project-based Section 8 that you've awarded, and that's long-term.
Okay. Well, I know we have SROs, probably more SROs there than we get at the California Hotel, right?
They're adding, and they're not actually SROs anymore. I think in the rehab, they don't qualify. They're studios.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So we had one activity that in the report says closed out, but we're going to change the language on that just a little bit. We're not actually closing it out. We're removing that activity from the ongoing activity section in our report, which is the use of replacement housing factor funds to develop non-public housing units. And we've talked about this before at the board retreat about the replacement housing factor fund. So that is something that we are going to be doing, using that funding to help do developments with project-based voucher units instead of public housing units. But it's no longer... The MTW office essentially decided that it's now part of our agreement. It's not something we need specific authorization to do like we do for our other activities. So it's going to be reported as part of our sources and uses in our financial section in terms of how we're spending the money, but we don't have to separate it out anymore. So that's what's happening with that one. And then we have 16 ongoing implemented activities. Seven of them are, their primary objective is to increase housing choices, seven with the primary objective to reduce costs and increase cost effectiveness, and two of them are specifically targeted as incentives to promote self-sufficiency. So of all of our MTW activities, we had, of the ones that were implemented, the 16, we had two that were not used this fiscal year. And those were our PBV occupancy standards. We changed the occupancy standards to allow a definition of senior at 55 and older. We only had three households take advantage of that this year. We only projected eight, so it was not as used as we thought. But we do think as the program goes on that this will be a really useful feature for some families to take advantage of. So. We didn't meet the goal, but I mean, I'm sorry, I skipped one. We didn't meet the goal. I moved on to the not met one. We didn't meet the goal, but it's something that we think will be used in the future, and it's certainly a good activity. I'll just tell you about the other one that we didn't meet since I skipped that. So the other one that we didn't meet was the acceptance of a lower HAP payment in PB project-based vouchered sites. And basically that was originally designed for our scattered sites as part of the disposition, where we chose to accept a lower housing assistance payment than would be eligible. And primarily that was done so that we could make sure that the households, the families that were in place, could remain in place. So again, that's another one where our benchmark was just too high. It is being utilized. It's just not being utilized at the rate that we originally anticipated. And frankly, we should have revised the benchmark for this year, and somehow we missed it. So we had 16 households that were overhoused that were assisted by that activity, but that was under what we had projected. As far as ones that weren't utilized, which is where I started, we had a combined, one was the combined project-based voucher housing assistance payment for non-contiguous sites. Basically, that's an activity that allows you to do a single housing assistance payment contract for multiple sites that aren't next to each other. And the regulations don't allow for that typically. We got the waiver to do that. We utilized it for our scattered site portfolio, so we only had to do 6 contracts, one for each AMP asset management property, as opposed to 254 of them. So it's been a great activity. We've also been able to use it at other properties for other project-based voucher sites. This year, however, we didn't have any properties that basically fell in that were eligible for that activity. Same with the alternative rent determinations, which is the use of a comparable rent study for multiple sites. Again, this was something we set up as part of the disposition so that we could use one rent study that was comparable for an entire area, as opposed to having to do 254 rent studies. So it's been very useful for us, but we didn't use it specifically this year. So these are activities that, again, are still current. They just weren't used this year. We had 6 activities that partially met the benchmarks. That basically means that some of the benchmarks we set for them, they met, and some of them they didn't meet. Activities can have more than one benchmark per activity, so those are the partial ones. And then we had 6 activities that met or exceeded the benchmarks. And I'm not going to list all of them, but it was our activities seem to be very successful and are certainly providing. Helping us reach those goals.
And the big important thing about our benchmarks and whether we meet or don't meet isn't really what HUD is looking at. What they're looking at is, does this work or does this not work? So with every activity that we have that we get exemptions from HUD for, we show, well, this is what we think it's gonna do. And then we can judge ourselves against that and see whether it was successful. A lot of these things that we're doing, particularly I think in the 6 that we met and the other ones, were things that HUD then pulled from MTW agencies like us and put into the ASEA bill that they've been shopping around and may go forward. These are all things that are in our activities and that made life easier and better for our residents and for this agency and help save money. Risk-based inspection, that kind of thing, changing the inspection schedules, all those really are what they're about. And the MTW program is not really about showing that we're so successful, because you learn as much from your mistakes and probably more than you do from your successes. And part of being a demonstration program like this is to be able to say there are things that either we didn't use or that didn't work, and be able to report that out to HUD and say, this didn't work. People were negatively impacted by this. And that kind of reporting is as, if not more, valuable than things we can say work.
So would it be fair to say that the activities represent things that the housing authority is undertaking in order to improve itself? And so we're kind of looking at those activities to see, you know, whether they're really working or not, whether they're things we want to do more of or not more of.
It's more we're demonstrating different ways of administering these programs in a way that the government could then take nationally.
I see.
So it's not really so specific in their agenda as OHA. It's much more, what can you test in Oakland that we could then copy and put into the CFR and save us some money and do a better program?
Yeah, I think, too, one of the ones that's been really successful for us and has been also at other MTW agencies is the triennial recertification schedule, where we're only having people come in for recertifications once every 3 years for elderly and disabled families on fixed incomes. So that's been extremely successful for us. That's also been demonstrated to be successful in other MTW agencies. And so that is something I think that was part of ASEA, the Section 8 reform bill that they're considering as rolling out nationally for all housing authorities.
Okay, I think Mr. Main has.
Yeah. I know we learn faster from our punishments too. But so I want to ask, when we make these mistakes, is there any, some of them I know probably are costly to us, but are the ones that we're making, are we being punished by them at all?
No. By HUD?
By HUD.
No.
That's
no.
The good news.
No, okay. and we exceed the number. The statutory objectives would be the only thing that could come back. The main one is that we serve more people than we initially do, and we do very well in that regard, even with all of the transition, even with all of the vacancy issues and things that we've had, because we're overleased in Section 8, we've always kept way above the percentage, and we'll get to that in a minute. And also keep in mind that doesn't include any of the units that we're holding, like next door. You did the walkthrough before the meeting. None of those are in our report, this report.
Yeah.
When we finish leasing up those properties, Lion Creek 4, not even going to Lion Creek 5, Lion Creek 4 and behind me in Cathedral, it only adds to the total number served, and our households go up. And so we're doing very well on those levels. And part of the program, and you talk about what we're demonstrating, is we have a huge amount of portfolio in transition, but we're able to serve the same people, the same number, and actually greater than we initially did. And we're doing that because we're using tenant-based vouchers if we don't have the unit ready, if we haven't leased the unit. So we're still serving the families. And I think that kind of model is what HUD's looking at, to make sure people do get housed, even when we've got all this stuff going on. And, you know, across the country, the condition of, for example, the public housing units are terrible. When they start really doing RAD, if they really do that and start trying to rehab those, there's going to be a huge dip in the number of households served in the country who go into that program while they do the rehab. Well, we've demonstrated a way that you can compensate that. You know, if HUD would have the flexibility to a non-MTW to merge your money and go overlease your vouchers to make up for that side so you can continue to serve a larger number, that's a very good program. And I think it's something that HUD should look to us very much toward in terms of how you move a property from public housing to project-based Section 8, first in a way that doesn't make people homeless, secondly in a way that takes the time and does it correctly, and lastly, in terms of the rehab, it takes time. We all have limited capacities and abilities, and if we get ahead of ourselves, we're only going to hurt ourselves. But if we can do it in a more concerted way and get better at it, as all the other agencies, I think, who go for RAD will have to do. But in the meantime, you're still serving the family on the tenant-based program by overleasing. You're doing a very good thing. You're still serving the people, and you're going to have a much better product in your community down the road.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I just want to add, too, that I think, especially the ones where we partially met the benchmarks, you know, a lot of times what happens is that, we expect a reduction in the costs or certain things like that. And sometimes what happens is that we do achieve a reduction. It's just not to the extent that we anticipated. And what we learn from that is all the other factors that go into play in what impacts that number. So I think sometimes when we think through it, you know, originally when we did the triennial recertifications, we thought, well, it's going to go down by 30%, right? You're cutting it a third, so you're doing it once every 3 years. It should go down, something like that. And what we found was that there actually was additional time in doing, they're doing a cost of living adjustment in the interim years where people don't have to come in and provide any paperwork, but it does require staff time. So what we found was that the reduction wasn't quite as significant as we originally anticipated, but it's still a very successful program. And in fact, that information helps us fill out that whole picture and helps us really understand, you know, what does it take to make that activity successful. So it's definitely a learning process.
And although HUD may have as one of their statutory objectives the idea that everything's supposed to save them money, that is a HUD view, and I respect it. But I also know that there's inherent value in some of these programs that are not non-financial. If we can make it less burdensome on the families to stay in the program and come in, that's a value in itself. I wasn't willing to do that and say you couldn't come in for 3 years for a reexamination because your income went down because it would negatively impact our families. So consequently, the savings were not as great as they probably could have been if we took a very rigorous approach. But I don't want to do that. That's not the purpose of this. The purpose is to find reasonable savings and still have people be able to get access to programs and to the level that they want. And so if you have a reduced income, we still want them to come in and get their rent adjusted. But the majority of seniors don't ever have that kind of change. It's usually the working families that go up and down, and particularly in this economy. So we want to be cautious of that. In terms of the inspections, on the Section 8 side, one of the ancillary benefits that really has worked, that isn't really a financial as much as just a real one, is the quality of the housing that we're providing is much better maintained, because we're targeting our resources, what we have to inspection, toward those landlords that are most likely to fail, rather than sending them out to everybody equally. And that's the risk-based inspection that we've talked about, where you can get 3 years, 2 years, or every 6 months. Because the goal is not really whether you pass the inspection. The goal is that you're maintaining your property in a way that is decent, safe, and available, and of a quality that our residents expect and that we expect.
Okay, so that is essentially the presentation I had for you tonight. Like I said, we'll bring the financials as part of the report next month for action next month. But for now, that's...
And Anna will be actually at Pacific Southwest NARO next... Oh, no, she's not. She's here, so feel free to hold your questions.
That's right. You can ask me more next time, though. You can think about it.
Yes, she's going to be here. And additionally, I believe our speaker is in the room, Chair, if you'd like to call.
On item D, is Tara Paye. Is it Paye here now?
Yeah, the mic's over there.
Oh, okay.
You can just use the mic at the podium.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, so good evening.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hopefully you guys remember me from last month, that I came before you to tell you about my issue that I was having with Oakland Housing Authority, as well as the unit that I am living in currently right now under the project voucher program. And I just wanted to come forward and let you know that Oakland Housing Authority executive management had resolved my problem, and now I have a housing choice voucher. And I am just honored to come, to come before you and let you know that the prospect and how they worked hard to resolve this problem, and anything that can be done through communications as well as a resolution to get things done. And I felt that the House of Congress need to act like that. Seriously. So again, thank you everyone for listening to me last month, and thank you Housing Authority for coming through for me, because you took a lot off my shoulder. And I'm glad to hear that you had passed a resolution for the censors, for the shot spotters. Yeah, because just Saturday there was shots. Felt like it was like right under my door. Well, not my door, but my window. And I was like, maybe I should call, but why?
Now you know.
But so I'm glad that you guys are doing that. And again, I just want to say thank you, Mr. Johnson, as well as your staff, for coming through for me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Chair. I want to thank you for coming in the first time to bring your problem in, but I especially want to thank you for coming in this second time just to give us some good news, because, you
Absolutely.
Know, so often we're hearing people coming in and they're, you know, complaining with problems, and then we're, you know, and then now we hear a real success story here. So I thank you.
Oh, well, you're so welcome. And if I need you in the future, will you be there?
We are always here to listen.
No, because the reason why I'm saying that is just because of the fact was that when I was hearing Mr. Johnson talking about housing through the HUD, and definitely need housing, and I would like to know, I'm going to bring this issue up with my case against PG&E. So if I need you guys to have, can I have you as backup?
That's a little out
what'd you,
of our
What'd you
range.
Say, Moses? I can't rely upon you? Oh, yeah, well, Mr. Johnson, definitely. Because this is out of control.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Okay. Janet, yeah.
Are all of the graphics that were in the PowerPoint, are they inside of the report? I was looking for one specifically, but
they aren't. We just did them today, to be honest with you, so they're not included in the packet.
Okay, because there's... So could I get a copy of the PowerPoint? Is that okay? Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair.
Oh, Ms. Hurd has a question.
Edwin, thank you for your report. It was great. On page 20, under the Shelter Plus Care program, the new policy that was put into place by the county, it says that if a person refuses or kicked off the wait list, now you gave us a number of 242.
Yes.
Is that that number?
That's how many people we have vouchers for in that program.
Okay, so... Thank you, Greg.
Okay, 242 is how many vouchers we have, Shelter Plus Care vouchers that we have, okay. And the county administers them.
Okay, so it says if they refuse the referral, they're mm-hmm. kicked off.
Mm-hmm.
So then what happens to them?
They have to reapply.
They have to reapply.
Yeah. Now, I will say that I did speak with the person at the county who provided this information to me, and she said that, you know, this is really in extreme cases where they've contacted them and they've gone through kind of multiple attempts with them, and the person is sort of not responding, basically. And it, and as it says, absent sort of a whole list of reasons, I mean, if they have a case manager working with them or any other, basically it's people that they've sort of lost contact with in a lot of ways where they're trying to get in touch with them and they're trying to get them and they're just not accepting the housing referral. And they do it primarily because they want to make sure that those vouchers get used.
Okay, great. Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you for this report because I was impressed with the glossary of the acronyms. Mm-hmm. It was excellent.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so many times you're on a board or a commission, and so many times people fail to realize that you may not understand every, you know, thing. So you need to explain some of the, say, for instance, OHA, I know what that is, but then there are others in here, and it's mm-hmm. a whole bunch. Mm-hmm. So I just want to congratulate you for an excellent job. Well done. And it really will help me throughout the rest of my career as a commissioner. Thank you.
Well, good. Thank you. Welcome.
So for the MTW activities, some goals which we met, some mm-hmm. which you spoke about, which we did not meet, can you remind me about the process for... looking at the FY 2013 year and what goals are going to carry over and what mm-hmm. are not, and remind me just kind of when in our year we look
sure.
at those.
And just to before she answers that, just to remind people, and it's a good question because the calendar gets really weird with HUD. We are reporting on not the plan you passed last spring, but the one you did a year ago last mm-hmm. spring.
And the other thing I was going to say is because of the timing, which is very odd, So we do the report now, but we did the plan in April, basically. So we do the report. I mean, we set up the plan for this year before we know how we've done on the report from the last year.
Yeah.
So it is challenging, and that's why you end up with a benchmark that should have been revised the last time but wasn't, because I revised it in the report, but then it never got updated in the plan because the plan came out so much
right.
afterwards.
Okay.
And basically, with the plan, you can make minor changes to the plan. Anything significant requires an amendment to the plan, so it's a lengthy process. And unless there's something substantial, it's generally probably, you know, not worth it to go through that process. You can do some technical amendments to your plan that don't require a public comment and kind of all that process, especially for things where you're just revising a benchmark number or something like that. But generally speaking, I think we look at, you know, When we're doing, like, for instance, when we're doing the plan this year, I look at the report from the previous year because that's the most current data I have, and then try and, you know, talk with everybody about, do these goals seem like they're effective? Do we seem like we're measuring the right thing? What do we think needs to be changed based on what we learned from the previous year? Now, again, calendar being weird, there may be things that you learned last year but that aren't applicable this year. So that's why it does get kind of, it is hard sometimes to try and set these benchmarks and make them realistic for the current year.
Right. So theoretically, we would be analyzing the year that was prior to setting up goals for the next year so that we can actually benchmark accurate goals. But you're saying the goals for the next year comes before the evaluation.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a disconnect in timing. So you're always a year behind in being able to correct things. And I think HUD understands the year behind, but it's just their calendar, and it coincides with the regular non-MTW agency's annual plan calendar for the fiscal year. So we're always going to have the disconnect.
Because I was thinking about that in the context of, we're talking about the lessons that we're able to promote to other MTWs, and I'm sure there are a ton that we're learning from other MTW agencies. And so I assume based on the timeline of reporting, we're unable to accurately look at other MTW plans from other agencies and integrate kind of lessons learned or different ideas that you can glean from them.
That's not really
true. Not totally, because every MTW agency does their reporting and planning based on their fiscal year. So there are some agencies that, for example, have a March 31st fiscal year end, and there's some that end in September 30th. December 31st. So there's a variety of fiscal year timeframes, and then the reports are, coming out all over the place. I mean, so it's an interesting thing because we can be finishing our report and we've already done our plan for the next year, and then I talk to colleagues in other MTW agencies and they're just starting their plan for the next year and they haven't even gotten to their report because they haven't finished their fiscal year yet, so there is a lot of overlap. You tend to always be getting sort of late information to some extent because the reports come out 3 months after the fiscal year ends basically, but I definitely do research on other MTW agencies to see not only what are they doing, but how are they measuring it? What are some of the tricks they've learned, or what are some of the things they're learning that we could apply, and vice versa too. I know people look at our reports as well.
And I would say what Anna Gwen isn't saying, that in terms of our report, since she's joined us, she's made a number of changes to the way we do our report, and it's now one of the model reports HUD has sending other agencies. Why don't you do it this way? And I just want to throw that out. Yeah. And the other thing that I would just mention in terms of reporting, this is the annual report that goes to HUD. We don't think this captures our successes and our innovations well. We think we could do a better job at doing that. And the GAO's office, Government Accountability Office, issued a report on MTW agencies and had some suggestions toward that. There's also an attachment B to this that the OMB, the Office of Budget and Management and Budget, which is actually the Office of the President, got involved in approving, and it's been a very delayed issue. As a response to that, the MTW agencies are convening a meeting in Chicago the first week in October, which we're helping coordinate to try and come up with a different way to tell HUD what works and doesn't work and really evaluate us in a much better way than what they're trying. It would include a different report if that were to ever move forward. But what we want to do is be on the record as a group of MTW agencies so that they can capture our whole story. One of the problems we've had in D.C. and time and again is that if they use only HUD numbers, only what goes into HUD systems to say, who we're serving or what we're doing, trying to put us into a non-MTW box, it doesn't fit. So the numbers are never accurate. And by HUD's own admission, it won't fit. But they continue to try and drive us in that direction, and the GAO's report did quite the opposite. They said we should be monitored based on our statutory objectives, and that we should find it, and that HUD needs to find a better way to monitor and evaluate us. So the group of MTW agencies, which is the majority of agencies across the country, are going to convene for a day and a half we have working groups now going on to try and propose something back to HUD and our elected officials, showing them how we think we could do a better job than the report you're viewing now at telling our story and holding us accountable.
And that's why the charts that I had at the beginning aren't in the report, because they don't actually ask those questions in the report, but they are part of what we're required to accomplish. So that is one of the disconnects.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Great. And there's no action required today. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
Again. Yes, indeed. And so now, onward to item E.
Item E is approval of an additional contribution to the California Public Employees Retirement System, CalPERS, employer and employee pension benefit for both safety police and miscellaneous plans. Miscellaneous plans is the majority of our employees, but there's a separate plan for police. I had mentioned this at a couple of earlier meetings about the valuation that we have were expecting from CalPERS. This covers us from one period, and I have Deputy Executive Director Janet Rice and our Director of Finance, Tony Ma, who I'm going to turn it over to discuss why we're doing this today.
Move the item.
No, give a brief presentation.
Good evening, Tony Ma, Director of Finance. What we're trying to do is basically...
Just talk into it, Tony.
What we're trying to do is basically take care of tomorrow's problems today. You hear a lot about cities and municipalities, about how they're having pension issues, about how they're always short. So what we thought we would do is, since we have reserves and we have the ability now, what we wanted to do was fund the pension, just as we have you have authorized us to pre-fund the post-medical retirement benefit. What that does is, effectively, by funding it today, it'll basically lessen our expense in future years. So the conversation that you hear about from the cities and the municipalities about coming up short will not happen in the future. So that's why we're coming to you today, to ask that we can fund about $9.7 million to make up the difference that CalPERS has managed to lose in the 2008 financial meltdown.
And what brings this to us is when we got the valuation from CalPERS, and I believe this goes through June 30th. What's the closing date, 2010? Yeah. So we're going to get another valuation probably in November from 2010 to now. We think if we fund this, it'll probably be not dramatic, well, probably within the range. But we lost in terms of our retirement benefits because of the Great Recession. We lost a good deal of the valuation. So the money that employees have paid into it is not going to be able to sustain it. So CalPERS is asking all agencies to find a way to fund it. Coincidentally as well, or in tandem, there is also now a way that we have to book this as a liability on our accounting. Our auditor has recommended we pay this as soon as possible, and so we are bringing it before you as soon as possible to make the payment this year. In a previous action, we talked about post-retirement medical benefits, and that was a huge liability that we've had to fund as well. Our current liability is $37,987,178. By pre-funding it, that goes down substantially. So we are on the track of balancing whatever reserves we have every year to be able to make payments against that as soon as possible, because what it does is allow it then to go into CalPERS, generate interest, and lessen the amount of burden on the housing authority. It also is going to mean that we're not passing this buck to future generations of housing authority employees to pay, or the agency, or force the agency into a fiscal crisis because of the unmet amount. Most recently, in the City Council of Oakland, passed an ordinance or a resolution that is going to try and accommodate their payment sometime in 2014 or 2015. They have to start including it as a mechanism to push it forward. But that is dangerous. You're much better off fully funding your retirement and not burdening future budgets with it. One of the questions has to do with how much reserves we have, and that's really the balancing act. So we're asking for the authority to pay it as our reserves come in and as we can get some repayments. And really what it'll do is, we have a payment schedule that we had proposed when we had the initial item for the post-retirement medical benefits. And so we'll probably pace that out more to make these payments and then catch that up. So we will balance that based on whatever reserves we can accumulate. Certainly, it's money that we would rather spend in other activities, but it is a debt we owe. So it's something that we need to make whole, I think, to be a solvent agency. Do you have anything to add, Janet, to that?
I just wanted to say that this latest GASB requirement, even if the city is pushing it forward, it's going to increase their liability.
Is that on? Can you double check it? I don't hear it going on. Okay.
Just
Rise, Deputy Executive Director. I just wanted to add that by pushing any liability that's unfunded into the future only increases your liability. So this new GASB ruling that came out in June is very new, and it's for all public agencies requiring you. It used to be just a footnote in our financial statements of the unfunded obligation, and now it is going to be a balance sheet item. So you will list it as if it were your accounts payable or any other liability that you owe right away. So theoretically, a lot of public agency balance sheets will become upside down, meaning that they will be in the red because they will have to show their pension liability. This new GASB ruling is also requiring us to calculate interest every year on what that pension liability is going to be. So this is not something, it's a major, major change for the financial industry and for public agencies. And so even our accountants are going to be recalibrating and recalculating based on the changes that we've made in not only trying to catch up our unmet liability, but what it means for future liability to the housing authority. So this is a definite prudent move in order to minimize and make sure that we are financially solvent.
So in the event, Janet, that we make the payment and this passes tonight, and then years go by and suddenly there's a huge upturn in the amount of money that we have invested, is this a one-way street, or can we get money back if
So typically they recalibrate, they recalculate your actuarial values, so it depends on your employees, but you in essence would be making sure that your liability does not go up, it would go down. So if you fund this and say, for instance, CalPERS has investment returns that are higher than anticipated, then the authority would realize the benefit of that value so that the following year your payment would not be as high, would be offset.
You understand?
So you're positioning yourself well by taking care of it now.
Yeah, that's cool. Yes, Mr. Negron.
Janet and Tony, I thought you were going to go the other way, Eric, with your optimistic question. Is CalPERS guaranteeing? So it seems like there was a certain contribution, market downturn in 08. Public agencies need to subsidize that gap. And for us, it's 9.7. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen in 3 or 4 years, or if and when there's another financial meltdown? Are they guaranteeing that any future gap will be funded by them, or is this going to be, we're kind of doing as we're told right now?
We're a contract agency, so we're not the state, and that's an important distinction because they have a contract with us, we have a contract with them that we're paying in using them as our retirement service, basically.
Correct. So they don't guarantee. Basically, they are probably the best investment firm you're going to have when we evaluated CalPERS earlier on even the post-medical retirement. What they will do is in about 60 days, they're going to recalibrate and look at our numbers as of June 30th, 2011. That will be our first indication whether or not we'll know if we're 100% funded based on our contribution now. Once that happens, then either we can choose to increase and fund it more, so whatever the gap is, or if it is less, then basically we'll realize that differential at that time. And so they'll do that probably every couple of years, 2 to 3 years, and then that's when they'll tell you whether or not you have a gap or you're fully funded. And so it's part of your financial evaluation of your organization because that number will be now on your balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So you have to know what that is in order to say, are you fiscally stable or not? That was the goal of this new GASB ruling, is to make sure that public agencies, people didn't know. They don't know what their pension liability, the full amount of it is. And now they're making you actually calculate that based on compensation changes and interest earnings that either have happened or not.
It's going to be interesting to watch how that impacts all the jurisdictions. As you know, we've had several cities and government agencies declare bankruptcy, Stockton, San Bernardino. This is going to exacerbate that issue considerably, because they're not going to have the resources to make the deficit funding available. So those decisions, I think, are going to become a lot more obvious to some of the people who oversee those agencies.
Okay, Commissioner Main.
So do we have a line item and our reserves obligating our reserves or the unfunded liability to say that this amount needs to be, is not just reserves, but obligated reserves for unfunded liabilities?
We don't unless you take the action tonight. In other words, unless the resolution passed, it's not obligated. Yeah.
I made the motion already. It's done. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And a vote. Yes.
Okay.
I was talking about for the future, though, not just this one.
That would be an annual report, so it'd be incorporated in the annual. What this will do is pass a resolution that takes the money. You know, we've talked about obligation of reserves and HUD's ability to try and recapture unobligated reserves, so that we can tag the money as being obligated to HUD, and the resolution should accomplish that.
For the future, also.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we intend to try and make the payment on this as soon as possible.
Right.
And hold the Gatsby one later. Okay. The post retirement medical benefits down the road.
Commissioner Hurd.
Okay, Janet, I was looking at our contribution rate, 3.291. And up above it says that we will not be able to say what the 2013-2014 employer contribution rate is until we complete the 2011 evaluation in October. Does that mean the rate will go down or up?
We don't know. That's when they will do a recalculation based
on... They will do the recalculation.
CalPERS will do a recalculation based on our staffing and any compensation changes that we have right now, and then they'll figure it out what impact does that have over the pension liability over the long term.
Okay, great.
And then we'll be coming back to you and informing you of that as well.
Thank you, Janet.
Okay, so we have a motion.
And they'll take the motion.
And there is a second. So all those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? Hearing none, motion carries unanimously.
On behalf of all current and future employees of the Housing Authority, I thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on then to item F.
Item F. Item F is a presentation and discussion of a new OHA website. It's been in development, and we also have included the OHA brand guidelines that Greer McVeigh has created for us. She is our communication manager and has worked tirelessly with the vendors you awarded earlier this year to create a website. And I think she's going to be able to walk us through it. And you'll need to use the mic, Greer. To give you the look and feel of what it is, you'll note the verbiage in your packet is all in Latin and gobbledygook, and that's so you can focus on the look rather than the content. And it wasn't just because I would start trying to edit it. They just apparently it's a normal thing for everybody to do, so they like you just to look at the view of it and rather than the look at the way it's going to look rather than the content. The content is also being developed by the different departments of updating our current site, but this will also include some increased functionality that I think you've been asking for. Okay. So is this the slide you want? There you go.
That's it. When you started, that was correct.
Okay.
That should probably do. Okay. And then is it okay to start with brand guideline and then go to
the Yeah. Do you have the mic? Yeah, unfortunately, you got to use the mic if you can.
Good evening. Good evening.
I'm Greer McVeigh, Communications Manager. Thank you, Commissioners, for hearing me out here. Last year, we brought, as our executive director indicated, last year we came to you with an integrated strategic communications plan. And in that plan, we talked about the branding, how we want to present ourselves to the public, how we would incorporate some of those brand attributes and the various pieces of collateral that we produce throughout the year. And within that discussion, I did promise a brand guideline or a brand guidebook at a later date. So that later date is now. So what I'm going to show you or walk you through is the recommendation for what the brand guidelines would be, how we would use it, who would use it, and so forth. The first part of this presentation, I'm not going to, get into a lot of the detail of what it says about about our brand, because that was in the other communications plan. So I'm just going to sort of walk through that and then get to some of the fun stuff, the fun, pretty stuff that we get to see. So who we are and the defining the brand, how we want to be perceived is included in this early part. We want to be professional and respectful to our clients and accountable and some other attributes like that. We've got to establish the brand. You coming out? We've got to establish the brand and put that out there, let people know who we are, and that comes through a lot of the marketing collateral that we do, the way we talk to our customers and so forth. So that information is here included. The brand values, what we stand for, the brand promise, which is what we promise people we're going to be timely and so forth. So that information is here. So whoever reads the plan would be able to see that. And this list here that you see, that when we walk through this, you could actually see it because it was big. So it's very difficult to see. But this has all the attributes that our leadership team established that we were going to, that would come through in the various pieces of collateral that we do. Trustworthy, service-oriented, professional, courteous, and so forth. Then, and eventually we get to living the brand. So it's not just what we look like on paper or what we say we're going to do. We actually have to do it. So if we say that we're timely, we need to be timely. If we say that we're professional, we need to be professional, and that comes through in how we staff our team and how we interact with people and everything that we do. We need to live the brand. Then when we get into the execution of the brand, that's when it gets a little bit more fun. So I just want to show you, when I say a brand guidebook, this is what it looks like. It is an actual book. It would be bound. And everyone within the agency, or certainly everyone who produces collateral material, particularly public-facing material, would be expected to adhere to the brand guidelines. So within this document, we get into how you deal with our logo, the sizing of our logo, the layout of our logo, the spacing between the letters of the logo, and I get into a lot of detail, granular detail, because the logo is the thing that when people look at it, they know who we are, they can see it at a distance, they see the house. And whether it's the entire logo with the house and the Oakland Housing Authority words, if it's the house by itself, the Oakland Housing Authority by itself, and so forth, that is what people, when people see that, they need to be able to think of us, and we want them to in turn think professional, service-oriented, helpful, and so on. The logo palette, or the colors that our logo is supposed to be depicted in every instance. So when we talk about, we have our green, we have black, we can do the logo in a black and white depending on what the collateral is. There are very specific colors, PMS colors or RGB colors. I'm not going to get into the technical of that, but there are specific colors that people need to use. Sometimes outside agencies or other organizations, nonprofits that we may partner with will ask us for our logo, or will ask us, if they're putting together a poster or a billboard or whatever they might do, we need to make take the extra step of giving them our guidelines and telling them what our expectations are of their use of our logo and any other elements that are associated with our brand. In some rare instances, we would use an alternate logo. So the logo that you see on the wall behind you with the house and the Oakland Housing Authority, that's a stacked logo. That's how it's supposed to be. That's how our logo was designed. That's how the Board of Commissioners, that's what the Board of Commissioners approved. It was before I got here, but as I understand, it was after some lengthy discussion and negotiating that you came with that. So all of the, or any alternate uses of the logo do take that into account, and then we worked hard to make sure that the consistency carried through. But again, in some rare instances, we might have cause to use the logo spread across, as is indicated on top of page 16. I'm sorry, I went ahead. That, at this point, I think the only use, authorized use we have of that would be on the website, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. And when I say authorized use, I mean where we are currently in our development of the website that we're going to present to you as a recommendation. Again, we do pay particular attention to the spacing of the logos, where the Oakland Housing Authority would sit in relation to the house and so forth. So there was some science behind this. If you use the Housing Authority, the words Oakland Housing Authority, without the house, again, there's a specific way you would do it, the house without the Oakland Housing Authority, there's a specific way. And then we also have a two-color version at the bottom that has the Oakland Housing Authority in green, and that, again, is something we would use in rare cases that's a one-color version. So if one color is the only option, again, depending on the collateral, if we're doing something partnering with another organization that is producing a one-color project, then we would use that. So we wanted to make sure we had enough variations that were consistent with the intent of the logo without deviating significantly. Then we have some unacceptable uses of the logo. I'm not going to get into all of them. Okay. And then color communication. So the color is, each color has some meaning. So when we produce collateral, you want to pay attention to what tone or message you're trying to impart, and then utilize color that represents that feeling. We've created a color palette. These are the colors that would be acceptable for our collateral. So they're not just colors that you pick willy-nilly. There are colors that are approved that are consistent with the OHA green and with the look and feel that we're trying to get across. Same with our fonts and typography. We don't just have a bunch of italics and things like that, so we want to make sure people are very aware of that. Here we have our 75th anniversary logo. As you probably know, next year, 2013, will be our 75th anniversary. So
These are only here as an example of a different logo, but they are things that Greer and I have been going back and forth in terms of having some way to put on with our logo or our own button for the 75th anniversary. She's also working on a calendar for the 75th anniversary as well.
Okay.
So these are not really approved. We just wanted to show you how you would amend a given logo, and that's what it's about, in different colors, adding the 75th anniversary. She put a tagline in there that I like, but I don't know we're going to keep. Bringing social justice to the built environment for 75 years. those were all just draft graphics we had to show you how we could manipulate the logo. And then the T-shirts. What? I hope we are. I just...
If you want to bring social justice, then we will definitely do that. So those are some examples.
I don't know if we've done it for 75 years, but I know we're trying to do it now.
Imagery, again, we get into what we want pictures to look like and what they should depict. appropriate uses of images and photos to tell a story, inappropriate uses of photos to tell a story. And then here are some examples of how the brand elements would carry through in various kinds of collateral. So here's an example of an email where the 75th logo might be part of someone's signature block. Here's our website, and I'm going to go over it in a moment, but here's just a screenshot of the homepage. And you can see the use of that Oakland Housing Authority and across the top. And again, I'll get into that in a moment. T-shirts, hats, tchotchkes. And then here, here's some screenshots of a sample calendar that we worked up that would show, you know, for the 75th year. So that's just to give you an idea of
how
you would use our branded look and feel.
And so that was all done as a precursor to trying to develop the look and feel of our website so that we have some really definitive and continuous things, and it moves throughout everything we do. And the, what I thought was particularly, I thought nice about what Greer's prepared is it directly correlates to the communication plan you saw earlier. And so it's just a question of just driving that in every aspect of what we're doing. And that's this is one part of that that I thought was worth seeing. So maybe on show us how the website is currently looking.
Okay. We've got a few pages of the website. I'm going to go through, spend probably the most time on the home page, which is what you see now, and then talk a little bit about a couple of the secondary pages or landing pages that come after this. So as it stands now, we've taken input from a lot of staff members, senior and on down, and everybody, not everybody, but quite a few people have had some input. What we want our website to be, first and foremost, is intuitive. We want people who visit the website to be able to find information or access the information they're looking for quickly and easily. We want it to make sense to them, but we also recognize that what makes sense to me might not make sense to you. So we've tried to position the information or the different pages in a variety of ways, so whether you are visually a visual person or some other kind of person, you can find that same information using two or three different ways and with as few keystrokes as possible, as few clicks as possible. We don't want you to have to go here and here and here and here to get to it. The across the top of the page, we have our, let me back up. One of the things that we tried to do is to bucket the information by function. Or by functional area, because we think that's a more intuitive way for people to find it. You know, if you don't really know the Oakland Housing Authority, you might not automatically think of procure. You know, if you want to do business with us, the word procurement, for instance, just might not resonate with you. But you would know, I want to do business with Oakland or working with OHA. So across the top, we have the general categories of those buckets. Down the left side on these lighter green tabs, we have what are called quick links. I need help, and again, the words that you see on the page may change. We can change that, but for now and for illustration purposes, I need housing. You know, I'm currently a resident, so if you're a resident and you want information about how to submit a maintenance request or something, you would quickly be able to click on that and get to it. I need housing. If you need housing, you would click on that and it would give you a submenu of options for people who need housing. One of which may say, you know, our Section 8 wait list is open. Another may say, you know, you need to call Eden INR or something like that. So again, that information we can still modify. Across the middle of the page, we have an image. And the image is intended to be visually stimulating. It captures you. It makes you feel something. There would be, and the number is flexible, but let's just say for the sake of arguments, 5 images, might be 4 or 5. We don't want too many. But they're on a carousel. So those images will change every few seconds.
the copy or the words that are on the image can be customized to take you to a particular page. So, for instance, if we have a Section 8 waitlist opening, that image could say, Section 8 waitlist opening, you know, now going on, click here. And you click there, and it would take you to that page. As you scroll down the page, so we've got a, further down the page, there's an open, a welcome message. There's a section here for news, announcements, and webinars. The news is current news that's going on in the city of Oakland. That would be on a scroll, and that changes constantly, so that people always feel like the website is current and up to date. The date on that changes as well. So if you come to it today or a month from now, it will be a different website. It'll look a little bit different, so you don't get that feeling that nobody is paying attention to it. The announcements would be announcements that we make, and then webinars are a feature that we would do in the future. Also have links to our Voice newsletter and to our owner newsletter, and then quick links at the bottom that would take you to various, it could be whatever we put there. It could be HUD, it could be other nonprofit organizations, it could be EDNINR or what have you. Further down the page, on the home page, there's information about how to contact us, FAQs, email. The email feature is I think, a really good one, because if people have a question and they want to contact us, and again, one of the things we want to do is make it easy for people to contact us and do the business that they want to do with the Housing Authority. So by having an email, it keeps people from having to call us. So it frees our staff up, but it'll, when you click on it, it enables you to sort of walk through a template, and that email will go directly to the department for the information that you're looking for. You can subscribe to our newsletters and other things, and that'll be fleshed out further. And then we'll have surveys that people can link to in real time, and then we can have that information. And at the very bottom of the page, there are links to other information, and we also have links to a glossary. And I heard someone, I think it was you, Commissioner Montgomery, that talked about having a glossary and being able to see those terms easily. And at the very bottom, you'll see our phone number. And one of the things that we want to do is to encourage people to use our website, not necessarily call us. So we put it there so they can find it, but not at the top. I do want to bring your attention to the color bars across the very top here. There's blue, yellow, red, and so forth. Those bars, when you click on those areas, so for instance, if you were to click on the residents, and I'll show you that in just a moment, but if you were to click on the resident, any resident page that you go to would have that yellow color or that orange color carry throughout those pages. So it would help orient you wherever you are on the website. So if you're on an orange page, you'd be on a resident page. At the very tip top, you see text size, so people can actually click on that to make the text larger or smaller. People like me, whose eyesight is starting to fail, will, you know, appreciate being able to make the words bigger. Also, there is a search feature, so that's one way you can get to information. So for instance, if you want to port in or whatever, you could type in portability or port or porting or something, and that'll bring up all the instances of that word and all the pages that are associated with that. We also have links to social media as well. So the next page is, if you just take a look at the very top bar, this is only going to show up once. The first time that you log on to the web page, you have the option of selecting the language that you want the website to display in on your computer. So unless you, like, delete your cookies and refresh, you may have to do it again. But that way, if you want to look at the website in another language, you can do that, and then it'll be set up from there on. And it automatically translates using a Google Translator. This page shows, when you do click on one of the quick tabs, what the sub menu looks like.
when you click on it. So more, so for instance, I'm a resident, and you can click there, and it might say, I want to, you know, submit a maintenance request, I want to move, I want to whatever things a resident might want to do. So again, you can get to that information quickly. This page here is what's called a sub page or a sub landing page. So if you click on the resident page, it'll take you to a resident landing page. And then there's more information about residents or information that'd be relevant to residents. There's a description of, you know, what public housing is and Section 8 housing, again, to help people. Some people don't know what kind of housing or what kind of voucher they have, so we can make that information very easy for them to find. And then this is an example of a department page. And again, you'd see that brown color. In this particular example, you'd see that brown color carry through in that page. So Joe Smith and Jane Smith are loyal employees of the Housing Authority. And that is the last page that we have to show you in this presentation tonight.
Thank you, Greer.
Thank you very much. Very good. I just have one question.
Yes.
What is the goal of the branding program? I mean, what is the final, what do we want to achieve, and who are we trying to influence with the branding?
Well, the branding relates to the communication plan. And when you say branding, it's really, I mean, that's a weird, you think of Cheerios or something.
No, I know. Yeah.
But it's not what we're talking about. We're just talking about when you use our logo, it doesn't get distorted and turn out in odd ways. And we didn't really have something we could email to folks. So when we do like ads in EBPO's newspaper, you know, flyer, we made sure they're correct, but we want to make sure there's the guidelines. So the people who print that, we can email this to and say, these are the color choices, this is the font, and they can create it very easily.
I was actually referring more to the image.
The branding relates to the way people perceive the Oakland Housing Authority.
That's right.
And we want to influence the way people perceive the Oakland Housing Authority by being...
So in other words, everyone, including...
Everyone.
The,
and we have a number of audiences.
Okay, good.
And the brand or the material that we produce varies by audience. So our objective would be to position ourselves in a way that regardless of who we're talking to them in a way that is consistent and clear and concise and represents who we are as an organization. That's the way we treat our employees, the way we treat our customers, our clients, our tenants, our vendors, and so on and so forth.
Great. Thank you. Oh, Commissioner Main.
Yeah. I want to move the item.
It's not an action item.
Well, it's a recommendation that we authorize the executive director to contract with Bayview Environmental.
Oh, no, you're on the consent calendar. We're on the previous presentation. We can move on to the consent calendar, but I think that we want to make sure we're done with this.
We're ahead of you.
Commissioner Castillo.
It looks really good. So much better than what we have now. I'm just really grateful that we're moving in this direction. You didn't mention videos, though I'm glad to see social media up here in the upper right-hand corner. So I presume we're moving into social media, which I think most of our low-income mothers and parents have a way to connect by Facebook and Twitter and text, and so I think that's really fantastic. But concerning logos being produced on videos that we make, perhaps you're exploring that, I presume.
Logo
on videos that
videos
we make?
That we produce, they would be professionally done. That would have our logo and who produced it and made it and the dates and
but
all.
But the
those
use of video on our website is something we are definitely looking at.
Yeah. We are looking at it, right? Because that's a medium that actually speaks to many at this point. So, the other thing I was wondering, you may have already told me, what software was used for the website, please?
It's SharePoint.
SharePoint.
SharePoint is the software, and it's still being developed. So we're, at this point, we're about to go into programming. I mean, we're prepared to go into programming and really do all the back-end stuff. But I wanted you guys to see and be able to chime in on where we are currently.
Last thing was that you mentioned that we're going to have news from the city of Oakland on the front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually
not relevant news to housing.
It's just
or?
It's like Good News Oakland, and it's a service that the city subscribes to that we can piggyback on that just keeps good news about Oakland. When they say, for example, we need the New York Times reported we were the top fifth most place to visit in the world this year. It's that kind of thing, and we can just piggyback on the city's site to do it. And what it does, its purpose is to one, sell Oakland, which I think we really need to do, but secondly, to make sure that whatever's on the website looks and is current, you know, so that you see it updated. Actually, is the perception for the public is this is a website someone's actually watching, and you're not looking at something that hasn't been touched in 10 years. Yeah. So it serves two purposes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I yield to her.
Okay. Commissioner Hurt.
She's vice chair.
Greer, thank you. This is beautiful. Now, I originally ran the question through the director regarding the email system, and he had indicated that we're going to need to build up the database.
Yes.
Before we start using it.
Yeah, so we will have the ability to send email blasts. So if there is communication that we want to get out to whatever audience, people can subscribe to that email list. And then when we have an announcement to make, for instance, Section 8 wait list is opening, All the people that have clicked on that is something that they want information about, we can send to them. Also, to the extent that we have other databases or other email lists generated through whatever mode, we could send communications to those people as well.
Okay. And then the residents will have an option there too?
I'm sorry?
The residents will have the same option as it relates to the emails.
Everybody would. We haven't talked a whole lot about the rollout of this.
Okay.
But we certainly would put a story in it in the Our Voice newsletter that says we've got this new website. Great. This is what it does. This is what you can do with that information and encourage people to subscribe to the various publications and things that we have on there.
And part of that challenge, Commissioner, is not to send too much stuff because people get overwhelmed.
Right.
And the other side of it is to try and drive everyone we can away from paper into electronics. So we've got also, our annual report, we're hoping to do more and more less printing and more online. The online report we published had much more information than the publication we emailed. And it was also easy for other people to share. And we got very, very good reaction to that this year. So we're open to use this to get that people off the idea of receiving paper and actually receiving it electronically.
Yeah, great. Oh, thanks.
Okay, Commissioner May.
I had a conversation with Eric about this earlier, so I kind of got through it. I was a whole lot of minutia that you have to sift through to make this thing work, and I'm really impressed that you handled it. I'm glad we don't have to make decisions on that. Thank the Lord.
Yes, thank you.
Very well said.
But one of the elements of this that I really, really appreciate, that I think is wonderful, is the fact that a person can go in and see whatever they need to see in the language that they're comfortable with. Okay, and that's a big deal because a lot of things that are happening in the city of Oakland don't include that. They have to talk to somebody and get them to translate for them in order to be able to access the information. Here they can read it for themselves and they can probably interact and learn what they need to know so that when they come to talk to somebody, they at least know what questions they need to ask and what information they actually need. And I want to praise the team for that. That's a wonderful item. And that's my comment. I want to move the item. No.
Well, Greer, thank you. This is really looking good. Well done.
Thank you.
To all.
Thank you.
Okay, so now we are on to item G, the consent agenda.
I'll move the consent agenda for approval.
Okay, it has been moved. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
We have a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, motion carries.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Yay.
All right, so now we're moving to item H, recognition of people wishing to address the commission. And we have four speakers, starting with Shelby Anguiano.
And you can use the mic at the podium.
And so we have 3 minutes per speaker, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Commissioners, for giving me this opportunity. I want to first acknowledge Commissioner Hartwig and Commissioner Hurd and say congratulations on your new appointment. I heard about that.
Thank you.
I'm here tonight. This may not be the perfect venue for this, but I really didn't feel like I had any other choice but this particular venue, and I do have some handouts for you that I want to pass out, if Inez would be so kind. There's one for each of you. I'm here to ask you to consider granting me a hearing for my recent termination. It's been about 90 days, but I'm a praying woman, and it's taken me about 90 days of praying to get to this point. To help you come to that decision, I'm passing out a letter that I'm going to be sending to HUD, as well as many, many, many other people. I have the list there of who all I will be sending my letter to. I want to share with you some of the contents of the letter that I intend to send to HUD, as well as fair housing, as well as state and local offices, authorities, and other interested persons. I'm going to send it tonight when I leave here, if we cannot reach a resolution about this matter. The issues include, but are not limited to, and I realize you may, I want to apologize for being the bearer of bad news. You guys got some really good news tonight. People gave you some really encouraging information, and I love it. I love that the Oakland Housing Authority is doing the wonderful things that it is. Those wonderful things aside, though, there are some things that it is not doing, and I think you should be aware of it. You may be aware of it. I don't know that HUD, Fair Housing, and other agencies are aware of it, and I intend to make them aware of it. Those issues include, I don't know if you realize, but there's no waiting list. There hasn't been a waiting list for close to a year. There's an exorbitant vacancy amount. No vacancies have been filled for almost a year. I don't know if you all are aware of that. When I got here, there were close to 400 vacancies. There's now quite a bit more than that, more coming up. One of the things that we did was we hid vacancies in the vacancy rate. I was not able to report to you accurately what the vacancy rates were. I was actually part of fraudulently reporting vacancies to HUD in the action plan as to when we were going to fill those vacancies. We weren't going to fill the vacancies because there was no way to fill the vacancies because there was no wait list and no referrals from the wait list. There is no wait list yet. My understanding is one is coming, but even if you get notice out that there is a wait list, you're going to have to wait for the applications to come in. You're going to have to process the applications. You have to get people on the wait list. It is probably going to be the first of next year before people start getting housed. And right now you're looking at about 600 vacancies that have been vacant for a long time. Some of your vacancies have been vacant for 5 to 6 years. I found all this out when I was here. I made a report, and I was terminated. And that's why I'm here, because I think you all need to know before I inform all of these people of what's happening in the operations department. Is anybody going?
Okay.
Thank you.
Three more?
Thank you.
Okay, so
Who's ceding the time?
Yeah, who? Armando.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Okay. In addition.
And the other guy is too.
Thank you. Should I continue? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. In addition to the excessive amount of units, the time it takes to turn a unit, I don't know if you all are aware of this, but on the site level, it's 200 to 300 days. When it's CID involved, it's over a year. I did the reports. I did the investigation. I went and looked at units. I had staff go look at units. There are over 200 units now that are vacant, done, sitting with nobody in them, and nobody planned to go in them. And I understand, you know, it takes a lot to do this, but that I don't think that's what the mission of this housing authority is. We live in a city where there's a high homeless rate. We live in a city where there's a high low income rate. People are asking for housing, and there's housing sitting out there. There are units that have been burned out that haven't even been looked at in 2 years, although claims have been made. There are units where there's 8 to 16 units in a building, and there's one tenant, and there has been one tenant for like 2 years. And that tenant has complained and said, I'm afraid being here. I live here by myself. There are units that are routinely vandalized. There are buildings that are boarded up. There are buildings where 2 or 3 years ago, cabinets and tubs and things were taken to renovate those units, and they're sitting there, just sitting. I took pictures of them. Nothing's being done about that. There's other issues. There were, when I came, there were over 100 requests for reasonable accommodation that were not processed. Some of those accommodations, some of those requests were inaccurately denied, lost, misplaced, never responded to. There are security deposits that have not been refunded back to 1976. When I asked about that and I brought to the attention the law regarding refunding security deposits or at least doing a disposition in 21 days, I was shut down. I was told, I was actually told, they're not getting their money back. I'm sure they've done some damage somewhere. That's not my background. That's not my training. That's not my certification. That's not the education and housing that I got. When I came to Oakland Housing Authority, I came because I thought this was the housing authority. I even said to people, I wanted to get in here. I wanted to work for this housing authority. We bought a house in Oakland. I live in Oakland. Oakland is my town. And I have to tell you, I was appalled at what I found in operations. Section 8, I can't say anything about Section 8 other than the fact that you're overfunded or over-issuing vouchers in Section 8. That's wonderful, but it doesn't compensate for what's not happening in the operations department. There is massive theft. There is procurement violations. There is bullying. There is harassment of various types. There's disparate treatment. I sent a memo regarding that to HR. I never received a response about it.
Speaker's time is up. Do you want?
Is there any other
time? I give my time. Don't
thank you.
Yes, okay.
Thank you. Other things that came up were, one of these are actually on your agenda, your consent agenda this year. You're approving $1.8 million for garbage services. I was given a budget of $700,000 for garbage services. And when I brought it to everybody's attention, it was like, what's wrong with you? That's enough. That's what we put in for. The garbage was way more than that. So it went months without being paid. Purchase orders ran out. I couldn't pay bills. We couldn't buy things to do repairs or turn over units. All of these things were done while I was here, and I reported them, and I tried. I was met with hostility, animosity, unprofessionalism that I have never in all my career encountered. I tried to talk to Mr. Johnson about the waitlist issue. I got blown off, so I was like, okay. He doesn't want to hear it from me. The waitlist situation was so bad, it was transferred to another department. Again, development, Section 8, the police department, all of those departments, I believe, are doing what they're supposed to be doing, and they're to be commended. The operations department is a travesty. And Mr. Johnson is aware of it. Everybody is aware of it. I just don't know if you're aware of it. I don't think HUD is aware of it. I don't think Fair Housing is aware of it. I don't think the state is aware of it. I don't think the mayor is aware of it. I don't think the council members are aware of it. I don't think legal aid is aware of it. And I intend to make them all aware of it. Because this is my city. I live here. I'm a taxpayer. I'm a homeowner. I love Oakland. I believe Oakland Housing Authority could be the best in the nation, but I believe this cover-up is going to keep it from doing that. And I don't believe that me telling it is what's going to blow it up. It's going to come out sooner or later. Sooner or later. People are already saying, why do you have so many buildings sitting vacant? You do. You have a ton of buildings sitting vacant, just sitting. And some are ready, and nobody's been in them. They're just sitting there. So what I would like to do is be a part of correcting that, which is what I was doing when I was here. There were major issues between staff and the executive leadership of that department. And I resolved those issues. I mediated. I worked with staff. I got staff on board. But it's because I reported these things, as well as I reported the conduct of a director that was so unprofessional, so illegal, in my view. I couldn't ethically or morally not report it. Those things led to my termination. And so, like I said, I'm a praying woman, and I prayed a long, hard time on this, on whether I could go home. Oh, well, it's not my problem. It's not the staff's problem. It's not whatever happens to the residents of Oakland, whether the board knows or not, HUD knows, the people, taxpayers, whether they, it's not my problem. What do I care? I care. I do care. That's why I came to work here. It's because I care. And you can probably talk to almost everybody I work with maybe exception of one or two people, who will tell you I did care and they knew it and we work together, we resolve things together.
Speaker's time is up.
Thank you. And so what I would like to ask the board, I'm not asking you to reinstate me. I'm asking you to grant me due process and a hearing so that I can share with you these things and you can decide whether I did not perform to the standard of the position, as my termination letter said. That is not true. It is BS. And I apologize for that word, but it is. That is not what happened at all. And just because I'm on probation, although the employee manual says that a probationary person doesn't have appeal rights, I don't know that that's completely true. Probationary people do have some appeal rights. If I don't in this situation, that's fine. Grant me a hearing. I will delay, if not postpone, my letter, and we can work it out together, because that is what I do. That is my vocation. This wasn't a job to me. This is what I have spent 25 years of my life doing, is helping low-income people get in and stay in low-income housing, and helping management companies that manage low-income housing do that professionally, responsibly, and ethically. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
And you have my letter, you have the memo that I tried to send, and you have a list of who all that letter will go to.
Thank you.
All right.
So we will now move on to what's this?
And it's not a complete letter.
Oh, and item G, well, that's already over.
Item G's been, someone wanted to speak on item G?
Someone wanted to speak on item G?
Yes.
It's already been voted on. You still want to speak on it?
Yes, just general.
Huh?
Yes, general.
Okay.
Hi, folks. Barbara Lopez on behalf of SEIU 1021, represented employees at Oakland Housing Authority. Pleasure. I had this whole speech came up, and then I heard the lady before me. So there's just two thoughts I wanted to share as an Oakland resident, and then I want to go into the discussion about, real quickly, bargaining. The first thought is that I live in the East, and I actually, now that I think about what the speaker said before me, I've had a boarded up Oakland Housing Authority property two houses down from me for at least a year. So I do think that raises some concerns, as well as wondering what my role as a union rep is into raising some of the issues that are brought forth by workers. The issue around the eligibility lists and wait lists are things that our workers have mentioned to me. That's not necessarily my role, but I just want to put it out there as things that our workforce has felt really concerned about. And I think that the reason I'm here before you is to kind of go in the line of, you know, good news, and then I wouldn't say bad news, but maybe hopeful news. In terms of the hopeful news, as you know, we have two contracts with you. One of them has been agreed upon, as you heard. Yay. Can we have a yay for that? Yay. I think there's more relief from that side of the room, like, woo! Anyway, so we're happy about that, and we're happy that our maintenance workers are going to be going towards equity and getting the salaries more that's aligned with what we need to sustain a life here in the East Bay. The other contract, as you know, is our APA HAR folks, and it looks like we're moving forward towards mediation on that. I'm sure you've been briefed on that or not. Okay, well, you will be. And, you know, I just wanted to put out there that, you know, for us, and I was trying to sort of explain this, is that at the end of the day, part of it's a respect issue. And I know that sounds crazy because you're thinking to yourselves all these different things, but I think sometimes our workers, particularly our APAs and our HARs, feel unappreciated and not listened to. And the reason I started off the conversation with the lady who I don't know who was before me was because these are some of the things I've heard. Not everything, but a couple of things that I heard. And sometimes I don't feel like there's somewhere to pipeline upwards their ideas. And I think, you know, when we deal with the one issue that we haven't come into agreement with, because it's one issue, guys, one issue, part of it's the fact that they don't feel appreciated. And, you know, at the end of the day, you could say, well, the board had this policy of 15% or more in equity, but that it broke its own policy by giving equity to people who were under 10% who didn't have a job class. And so, you know, then you have our workforce who looks at itself and says, well, we're like that too. How come we're not getting that? So, you know, we're arguing over less than $100,000. And so I just want to put it all into perspective that we're so close, but we're not yet there. We were there on one contract, yay. But we're not there on the other one. And to just really think about how to build a better relationship with our workforce, it's really important. And it's hard sometimes when we come to these hearings and we see all this money spent, a lot of it on good things. I'm not going to say a lot of it isn't on good things. But, you know, I also represent OPD. And so I could tell you that there's been a lot of problems with ShotSpotter. You know, I hear gunshots all the time. Of course, I want something that captures them.
Speaker's time is up.
Oh, thank you. But I would read the August 1st San Francisco Chronicle article on ShotSpotters. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Does anyone have a question?
No.
No. Okay. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. So we'll now move on to written communications.
Great. Thank you, Commissioners. Written communications, the monthly reports in your packet, as always. Additionally, we had the Summer Education Initiative, and there's some highlights from the education program, our summer lunch program, Lockwood Gardens Summer Academy, Summer Employment and Education, Peralta Village Cyber Tutoring Program. And we really prepared this because the chair of the Education Committee wanted to get an update for the board, and that's what this is in there for. And she can give any reports of the summer activities as well. The Trust and Summer Day Camp is in your packet. I'll call out a couple of other additional things. One is we do have a table at the anniversary for Friday, September 7th, Christian Church Homes. You just toured their property before. If you'd like to attend, please let Inez and I Greer know, and we'll put you on the list. We are one of the sponsors of that, so we'd be happy to include you. I included a NARO award of a National Award of Excellence for the Palo Vista Rehabilitation Program. We have won the National Award of Excellence, which usually goes to major development projects, and then this time went to the rehabilitation program and that side. And I'm very grateful for the work of the Capital Improvements Department did to make that a reality through our FORCE account construction program. It worked really well, and I really am grateful for the recognition. We'll get the award at their conference at the end of October. I think it's Tuesday, October 30th. And so hopefully we'll have some commissioners there to accept the award as well. I included two information packets on CLOFA. That really just so you would understand some of the issues that we're facing in terms of a continuing resolution and the cuts by HUD. So you can feel free to give those a read. If you have any questions, give me a call. Basically, the issue is if they do a continuing resolution, it preserves the cuts that they put in the 2012 budget, which used our reserve levels. $1 billion worth of local agency reserve levels to try and balance the budget would get preserved into the continuing resolution. Because that's a big hardship on housing authorities, if they continue that, we're trying to seek a remedy for that with Congress where they would call that out and not have that go forward. And I just wanted you to be aware of those in case, you know, in any of your travels, people ask about it and what we would like to see happen. I also am including a report from the Office of Inspector General, who finished a five-month audit of this agency and found us. It's probably the best audit report I've ever had the OIG come out, looking at different aspects of the agency, and I'd encourage you to read it. We did have several units related to HQS. A lot of those fails were caused by tenants, and we did point that out in the report, but they tend to hold fast on whatever they have. But it was an extraordinarily, I think, informative audit. They did it electronically, so they audited lots of aspects of the housing authority. Because there were some minor findings related to the inspection, they actually issued a report. But I was grateful to have the report because so much of it basically said that allegations against the housing authority were generally not valid in a whole lot of other areas they looked into. And I thought that was worth having in writing. I included it in the packet because I wanted to make sure it was part of the board knew about it and that was part of the record. In addition to that, we have our meeting schedule coming up. We are having our next meeting September 24th. We have the Monday, October 22nd meeting, and then the rescheduled December 3rd meeting coming up, and there's some travel going on. I know several commissioners will be traveling in September to the conferences. In terms of opening our site-based public housing and project-based Section 8 wait lists, that is opening. There's a save the date for some of the nonprofits this week who will assist in the opening of it. We have completed the purge of that wait list. We have the, and I'm not sure how many total families after the purge. Janet? Yeah, 750 families who are still active on the wait list that we're working through. So we went through the purge prior to opening. And that's for the OP properties and the public housing properties that are on site-based wait lists. Additionally, for the OP properties, we're currently pulling bedroom size off the Section 8, offering it to the Section 8 wait list that we opened in 2011, and beginning to pull names off that list. So we're also offering 3 bedrooms. I believe we did a draw for people who were on the Section 8 wait list to see if they wanted a project-based Section 8 unit to help help with those activities. And I was grateful we finally started pulling from that wait list. It's been a long time. We're talking about trying to increase our leasing in the Section 8 as well as the OP sites related to that. Wait lists get stale very quick. Our 2009 wait list, which was the site base, is the one we purged. So out of the people we mailed to, only 750 are left now in those units requesting it. So we're working that data. In the interim, we use the project-based Section 8 list and be opening it up and give people another opportunity to be on the wait list. We'll continue to work through the Section 8 wait list for the voucher program. That was 10,000 people on that wait list. We lauterized it down from about 54,000. So there's a big demand for that program. But it does speak to trying to open our wait list more frequently and do the lottery, because it does provide people access. When you get to the bottom of the wait list, it gets harder and harder, and you have more people you call in end up not there. They don't respond, so the attrition rate goes way down, and that's what has really been a factor. We have moved the wait list management and eligibility over to the Leased Housing Department. And it was the OPO handled their own leasing, and wait list in the first round, but we moved everything over to Leased Housing. And so they are handling it out. That's some of my announcements. A couple other additional things in director's comments is we are sending 4 cadets and 2 of our officers to the 2012 West Coast Explorer competition. So I'm very happy they're going to get that opportunity, and that's with Chief Duplessis. Additionally, I just wanted to let you know some of the things that staff has done this summer. The OPD and Family and Community Partnerships and even OPO have really done so many activities with our youth above and beyond what they normally do. We've done a series of back-to-school things, but through the whole summer, just activities that help engage and promote kind of relationships between our staff, our police, and our residents and the youth. And to give you a few of them, August 1st, this is just this month, August 1st, they went to the A's game. The 3rd, they went to the A's game. And they did a bike ride to Treasure Island, which was actually the most popular bike ride by all the people, because I went biking with them one day, and that was their favorite day. Then they went to the A's game on the 5th. We had National Night Out on the 7th all over town. They did a fishing trip on the 11th. On the 15th, they did both a Coyote Creek bike ride. I think that's the one I went on to with them. And they also did a swimming trip to 49th Street. Pool. They went. They had a Campbell Village block party. The Peralta Village block party was on the 22nd, and that was so well attended. It was in partnership with OUSDPD, the old Cole Elementary that closed in the parking lot, and that was the first one. And I mean, it was packed. I was really pleased to see the turnout. Lockwood, we did our second back-to-school party. We did the first one last year, and that was enormously well attended, much better than the first. Gratefully, we did have backpacks for all. And I'm happy to report that. And I want to thank the chief and Patricia and Nicole and Janet for all, and Family and Community Partnerships staff up and down in the police department, because it really is a lot of work to do those kind of recreational kind of programs with food and everything else. And I mean, we had the maintenance guys and everybody helping, kick in that afternoon. And the reason it's important is it's all about building a safer neighborhood and caring for our kids. And I just think it's really right to our mission. And then we have actually a 48th Street block party coming up. That's tomorrow night. We had 9 community meetings in addition to doing that all this month. Additionally, Community and Family Partnerships Education Program organized the back-to-school call reminders, which staff participated in. And, in fact, so many staff volunteered to make calls that when it got to me, there was no one left to put on the list, which I regret. But everybody was taken, and they got the calls done in no time. And I think it's one of those things that our staff here, we started it last year, and it gives so many people who don't really have the chance to talk to the people who we work for, the residents, and to call them on a really positive aspect. So we have people in finance who process payroll calling and reminding parents about going back to school and where you can get shots, and here's some backpack giveaways you can go to. So that was all terrific, and I really I for one, am very grateful school started today, and I think that that's echoed throughout the whole agency, but I'm glad we could have something to do with hopefully the attendance on the first day and the attendance of our youth, every day on time, ready to learn. And that concludes my report.
All right. Well, thank you. And so do we have any reports of commission committees? Okay, none for this month. Okay. Are there any announcements by commissioners? Well, therefore, we have a motion.
Voter registration. Yeah.
So then, do we have a motion to adjourn to closed session?
I'd have made that motion.
All right.
We're adjourned.
So be it.
Thank
we
you,
are adjourned. And we'll take 5 minutes or so and reconvene. All right. So,